soon. My father will read out my letter to him there, stating Arthur Blackthorne's inability to run the Institute, and then announce his own candidacy.
They won't know what hit them, said Manuel, sliding his hands into his pockets.
And when it's all over, of course.
Don't worry, Zara said irritably.
You'll get what you want, though it would be better if you were more committed to the cause.
She had already turned away. Kit saw Manuel's eyes glint beneath his lashes as he looked after her. There was something in his expression, an unpleasant sort of hunger, though whether it was desire for Zara or something far more arcane, Kit couldn't tell.
Oh, I'm committed, said Manuel. I'd like to see the world burn clean of downworlders as much as you, Zara. I just don't believe in doing something for nothing.
Zara glanced back over her shoulder as she moved into the corridor Manuel had used as an entrance.
It won't be nothing, Manu, she said. I can promise you that.
And they were gone, leaving Kit, Ty, and Livy to huddle together in the mouth of the tunnel, stunned into silence. The sound that woke Christina was so faint she thought at first she might have imagined it. She lay, still tired, blinking against the foggy sunlight. She wondered how long it would be until sundown, when they could navigate by the stars again. The sound came again, a sweet, far-calling cry, and she sat up, shaking her hair. It was wet with dew. She combed her fingers through it, wishing for something to tie it back with. She hardly ever wore her hair down like this, and the weight against her neck was bothersome. She could see Julian and Emma both asleep, hunched figures on the ground. But where was Mark? His blanket was discarded, his boots lying beside it. The sight of the boots made her scramble up to her feet. They'd all been sleeping with their shoes on, just in case. Why would he take his off? She thought about waking up Emma, but likely she was being ridiculous. He'd probably just gone for a walk. She reached to pull her butterfly knife out of her weapons belt and started down the hill, moving past Jules and Emma as she did. She saw with a sort of pang in her heart that their hands between them were clasped. Somehow they'd found their way toward each other in sleep. She wondered if she should reach down, gently separate them. But no, she couldn't do that. There was no way to gently separate Jules and Emma. The mere action of separating them at all was like an act of violence, a tear in the fabric of the world. There was still heavy mist everywhere, and the sun pierced through it dimly in several places, creating a glowing white veil she could see through only in patches.
Mark,
she called softly.
Mark, where are you?
She caught the sound she had heard before, and now it was clearer. Music. The sound of a pipe, the twang of a harp string. She strained to hear more, and then nearly screamed as something touched her shoulder. She whirled and saw Mark in front of her, holding his hands up as if to ward her off.
I didn't mean to startle you, he said.
Mark, she breathed, and then paused.
Are you, Mark? Fairies weave illusions, don't they?
He cocked his head to the side. His blonde hair fell across his forehead. She remembered when it had hit his shoulders, as if he were an illustration of a fairy prince in a book. Now it was short, soft, and curling. She had given him a modern haircut, and it seemed odd suddenly, out of place in fairy.
I cannot hear my heart or what it tells me, he said. I can only hear the wind.
It was one of the first things he had ever said to her.
It is you,
she said, exhaling with relief.
What are you doing? Why aren't you sleeping? We need to rest if we are to arrive at the Unseelie Court by moon's rise.
Can't you hear the music? He said. It was louder now, the very clear sounds of fiddles and woodwinds and the sound of dancing, too, laughter and the stamp of feet.
It's a revel.
Christina's heart skipped a beat. Fairy revels were things out of legend. The fair folk danced to enchanted music, and drank enchanted wine, and sometimes they would dance for days. The food they ate made you delirious or love-struck or mad. It could pierce your dreams.
You should go back to sleep, Mark said. Revels can be dangerous.
I've always wanted to see one.
A surge of rebellion went through her. I'm going to go closer. Christina, don't. He sounded breathless as she turned and moved down the hill toward the noise. It's the music. It's making you want to dance. She whirled around, a curl of black hair sticking to her damp cheek.
You brought us here,
she said, and then plunged on toward the music, and it rose up and surrounded her, and she could hear Mark swearing but following after her. She reached a field at the foot of a hill and stopped to stare. The field was full of blurred, colorful movement. All around her, the music echoed, piercingly sweet. And everywhere, of course, there were fair folk. A troop of fairies in the center of the dancers, playing their instruments, their heads thrown back, their feet stamping the ground. There were green-skinned wood fairies dancing, with gnarled hands and eyes that glowed yellow as sap. Fairies, blue and green and shimmering as water, with hair like transparent netting cascading down to their feet. Beautiful girls with flowers wound through their hair, tied around their waists and throats, whose feet were hooves. Pretty boys in ragged clothes with fever-bright eyes who held out their hands as they spun by.
Come and dance, they called. Come and dance, beautiful girl, Chica Bella, come and dance with us.
Christina began to move toward them, toward the music and the dancing. The field was still clouded with fog, carving its streaks of white across the ground and hiding the blue of the sky. The mist glowed as she moved into it, heavy with strange scents, fruit and wine and incense-like smoke. She began to dance, moving her body to the music's rhythm. Exhilaration seemed to pour into her with every breath she took in. She was suddenly no longer the girl who had let Diego Rosales fool her not once but twice, not the girl who followed rules and trusted people until they broke her trust as casually as knocking a glass off a table. No longer the girl who stood back and let her friends be wild and crazy and waited to catch them when they fell. Now, she was the one falling. Hands seized her, spinning her around. Mark, his eyes were flashing. He pulled her up close against him, his arms slipping around her, but his grip was unyielding with anger. What are you doing, Christina? He asked in a low voice. You know about fairies. You know this is dangerous.
That's why I'm doing it, Mark.
She hadn't seen him look so furious since Kieran had come riding up to the Institute with Irloth and Gwyn. She felt a small, secret pulse of excitement inside her chest that she could make him look that angry.
They hate shadow hunters here. Don't you remember? He said. They don't know I'm a shadow hunter.
Believe me, said Mark, leaning in close so that she could feel his breath hot against her ear.
They know.
Then they don't care, said Christina. It's a revel. I've read about these. Fairies lose themselves in music like humans. They dance and they forget, just like us.
Mark's hands curved around her waist. It was a protective gesture, she told herself. It didn't mean anything, but her pulse quickened regardless. When Mark had first arrived at the Institute, he had been stick-thin, hollow-eyed. Now she could feel muscle over his bones, the hard strength of him against her.
I never asked you, he said as they moved among the crowd.
There were close to two girls dancing together. Both of them had their black hair bound up in elaborate crowns of berries and acorns. They wore dresses of russet and brown, ribbons around their slim throats, and swished their skirts away from Mark and Christina, laughing at the couple's clumsiness. Christina didn't mind.
Why fairies? Why did you make that the thing you studied?
Because of you.
She tilted her head back to look up at him, saw the surprise that passed across his expressive face, the beginning of the gentle curves of wonder at the corners of his mouth.
Because of you, Mark Blackthorn.
Me?
His lips shaped the word.
I was in my mother's rose garden when I heard what had happened to you, she said. I was only 13. The Dark War was ending, and the Cold Peace had been announced. The whole Shadowhunter world knew of your sister's exile, and that you had been abandoned. My great-uncle came out to tell me about it.
My family always used to joke that I was soft-hearted, and it was easy to make me cry.
and he knew I'd been worrying about you. So he told me, he said, "Your lost boy will never be found now."
Mark swallowed. Emotions passed like storm clouds behind his eyes. Not for him, Julian's guardedness, his shields.
"And did you?"
"Did I what?"
"Did you cry?"
he said. They were still moving together, in the dance, but it was almost mechanical now. Christina had forgotten the steps her feet were taking. She was aware only of Mark's breathing, her fingers locked behind Mark's neck, Mark in her arms.
"I did not cry," Christina said, "but I did decide that I would dedicate myself to eradicating the cold piece. It was not a fair law then. It will never be a fair law."
His lips parted. "Christina." A voice, like doves, interrupted them, soft, feathery, and light. It crooned,
"Drinks, madame and sir? Something to cool you after dancing?"
A fairy with a face like a cat's, furred and whiskered, stood before them in the tatters of an Edwardian suit. He held a gold plate on which were many small glasses containing liquids of different colors, blue, red, and amber.
"Is it enchanted?" Christina said breathlessly. "Will it give me strange dreams?"
"It will cool your thirst, lady," said the fairy, "and all I ask for in return is a smile from your lips."
Christina seized up the glass full of amber fluid. It tasted of passion fruit, sweet and tart. She took one swallow, and Mark dashed the glass from her hand. It fell tinkling at their feet, splashing his hand with liquid. He licked the fluid from his skin, glaring at her all the while. Christina backed away. She could feel a pleasant warmth spreading in her chest. The drinks seller was snapping at Mark, who pushed him away with a coin, a mundane penny, and started after Christina.
"Stop," he said. "Christina, slow down. You're going toward the center of the revel. The music will always be stronger there."
She stopped, held out a hand to him. She felt fearless. She knew she ought to be terrified. She had swallowed a fairy drink, and anything might happen. But instead, she felt as if she were flying. She was soaring free, only Mark here to tether her to the ground.
"Dance with me," she said.
He caught at her. He looked angry still, but he held her tightly nonetheless.
"You've had enough dancing and drinking."
"Enough dancing?"
It was the girls in russet again, their red mouths laughing. Other than their different colored eyes, they looked nearly identical. One of them pulled the ribbon from around her throat. Christina stared. Her neck was horribly scarred, as if her head had nearly been severed from her body.
"Dance together,"
the girl said, nearly spat it as if it were a curse, and looped the ribbon around Mark and Christina's wrists, binding them together.
"Enjoy the binding, hunter."
She grinned at Mark, and her teeth were black as if they'd been painted that color, and sharp as needles. Christina gasped, stumbled back, pulling Mark after her, the ribbon connecting them. It stretched like a rubber band, not breaking or fraying. Mark caught up to her, seizing her hand in his fingers threaded through hers. He drew her after him, fast and sure-footed on the uneven terrain, finding the breaks in the heavy mist. They pushed between dancing couples until the grass under them was no longer trampled and the music was faint in their ears. Mark veered to the side, making for a copse of trees. He slipped under the branches, holding the low-hanging ones aside to let Christina in after him. Once she had ducked underneath, he released them, closing them both into a dirt-floored space beneath the trees, hidden from the outside world by long branches laden with fruit that touched the ground. Mark sat down, drawing a knife from his belt. "Come here," he said, and when Christina came to sit beside him, he took her hand and slashed apart the ribbon binding them. It made a little shrieking, hurt sound, like a wounded animal, but frayed and gave. He let go of Christina and dropped the knife. Faint sunlight filtered down through the branches above, and in the dim illumination, the ribbon still around his wrist looked like blood. The ribbon was looped around Christina's wrist as well, no longer burning, trailing its lonely end in the dirt. She worried at it with her nails until it came free and fell to the ground. Her fingers kept slipping. Probably the fairy drink, still in her system, she thought. She glanced over at Mark. His face was drawn, his gold and blue eyes shadowed. "That could have been very bad," he said, casting the rest of his ribbon aside. "A binding spell like that can tie two people together and send one of them mad, make one of them drown themselves, and pull the other in after them." "Mark," Christina said, "I'm sorry. I should have listened to you. You know more about revels than I do. You have experience. I only have the books I read." "No," he said unexpectedly. "I wanted to go too. I like dancing with you. It was good to be there with someone human," Christina said. The heat in her chest had turned into a strange pinching feeling, a hot pressure that increased when she looked at him. The curves of his cheekbones, the hollows of his temples. His loose, wheat-colored shirt was open at the throat, and she could see that place she had always thought was the most beautiful spot on the man's body, the smooth muscle over the clavicle and the vulnerable hollow. "Yes, human," he said. "We are all human, I know. But I have almost never known anyone as human as you." Christina felt breathless. The fairy mist had stolen her breath, she thought. That and the enchantment all around them. "You are kind," he said. "One of the kindest people I have known. In the hunt, there was not much kindness. When I think that when the sentence of the cold peace was passed, there was someone 1,000 miles away from Idris, someone who had never met me but who cried for a boy who had been abandoned." "I said I didn't cry." Christina's voice hitched. Mark's hand was a pale blur. She felt his fingers against her face. They came away wet, shining in the mist light. "You're crying now," he said. When she caught at his hand, it was damp with her own tears. And when she leaned toward him through the mist and kissed him, she tasted salt. For a moment, Mark was startled, unmoving, and Christina felt a spear of terror go through her, worse than the sight of any demon, that Mark might not want this, that he might be horrified. "Christina," he said, as she broke away from him, and went up on his knees, his arm coming around her a little awkwardly, his hand burying itself in her hair. "Christina," he said again, with a break in his voice, the rough sound of desire. She put her hands on either side of his face, her palms in the hollows of his cheeks, and marveled at the softness where Diego had had stubble, rough against her skin. She let him come to her this time, closing her into the circle of his left arm, fitting his mouth to hers. Stars exploded behind her eyelids. Not just any stars, but the many-colored stars of fairy. She saw clouds and constellations. She tasted night air on his mouth. His lips moved frantically against hers. He was still whispering her name, incoherent between kisses. His free hand slid over her waist, up her side. He groaned when her fingers found their way into the neck of his shirt and brushed along his collarbone, touched the beating pulse in his throat. He said something in a language she didn't know, and then he was flat on the ground, and she was over him, and he was pulling her down, hands fierce on her back and her shoulders, and she wondered if this was how it had always been for him with Kieran, fierce and ungentle. She remembered seeing them kiss in the desert behind the Institute, and how it had been a frantic thing, a clash of bodies, and it had sparked desire in her then, and it did again now. He arched up, and she heard him gasp as she slid down his body, kissing his throat, and then his chest through his shirt, and then her fingers were on his buttons, and she heard him laugh breathlessly, saying her name, and then, "I never thought you'd even look at me. Not someone like you, Shadow Hunter royalty, like a princess." "It's amazing what a bit of enchanted fairy drink will do." She meant to sound teasing, light-hearted, but Mark went still under her. A moment later he had moved, quick and graceful, and was sitting at least a foot from her, his hands up as if to hold her away. Fairy drink? He echoed. Christina looked at him in surprise. The sweet drink the cat-faced man gave to me. You tasted it. There was nothing in it, Mark said with uncharacteristic sharpness. I knew the moment I put my lips to my skin. It was only brambleberry juice, Christina. Christina recoiled slightly, both from his anger and from the realization that there had been no blurring cloak of magic over the thing she'd just done. But I thought... You thought you were kissing me because you were intoxicated, Mark said. Not because you wanted to, or because you actually liked me. But I do like you. She rose to her knees, but Mark was already on his feet. I have, since I met you. Is that why you got together with Diego? Mark said, and then shook his head, backing up. Maybe I can't do this. Do what? Christina staggered upright. Be with a human who lies, Mark said, uninflected. But you have lied too, said Christina. You've lied about being with Emma, and you've taken part in the same lie. Because it has to be told, Christina said, for both their sakes. If Julian wasn't in love with her, then he wouldn't need to think. She broke off then as Mark went white in the shadows. What did you say? Christina put her hand to her mouth. The fact of Emma and Julian's feelings for each other was so rooted in what she knew about them that it was hard to remember others didn't know. It was so clear in their every word and gesture, even now. How could Mark not know? But they're parabatai, he said, bewildered. It's illegal. The punishment. Julian wouldn't. He just wouldn't. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have said anything. I was just guessing. You weren't guessing, Mark said and turned away from her, shoving his way out through the branches of the trees. Christina went after him. He had to understand. He couldn't say anything to Julian. Her betrayal weighted her heart like a stone. Her sense of humiliation, forgotten in her fear for Emma, her realization of what she'd done. She pushed through the tree branches, the dry-edged leaves scratching her skin. A moment later, she was outside on a green hill, and she saw Julian. The music woke Jules. The music and the enveloping sense of warmth. He hadn't been warm in so long, not even at night. Huddled in blankets. He blinked his eyes open. He could hear music in the distance, weaving feathery tendrils across the sky. He turned his head to the side and saw with a jolt of familiarity Emma beside him, her head on her jacket. Their hands were clasping on the grass between them, his tanned fingers wrapped tightly around her smaller ones. He drew his hand back fast, his heart pounding, and scrambled to his feet. He wondered if he'd reached out for her in his sleep, or had she reached for him? No, she wouldn't have reached out for him. She had Mark. She might have kissed him, Julian, but it was Mark's name, she'd said. He thought he would be all right, sleeping this close to her, but apparently he'd been wrong. His hand still felt as if it were burning, but the rest of his body was cold again. Emma murmured and turned, her blonde hair falling over her hand, now curled palm up on the grass as if she were reaching out for him. He couldn't stand it. He seized his jacket up off the ground, shrugged it on, and went to look out from the hill. Maybe he could tell how close they were to the foot of the mountains, how long it would take them to reach the Unseelie Court and end this insane mission. Not that he blamed Mark, he didn't. Kieran was like family to Mark, and Julian understood family better than he understood almost anything else. But he was already worried about the children at the Institute, whether they would be furious, panicked, unforgiving. He never left them before. Never. The wind changed and the music picked up. Julian found himself at the edge of the hill looking down at a vista of green grass, dotted here and there with copses of trees that swept down to a cleared space where a blur of color and movement was visible. Dancers. They were moving in time to the thrum of a music that seemed to well up from inside the earth. It was insistent, demanding. It called to you to join it, to be swept up and carried, the way that a wave might carry you from sea to shore. Julian felt the pull, though it was distant enough not to be uncomfortable. His fingers ached for his paintbrushes, though. Everywhere he looked, he saw an intensity of color and movement that made him wish he was in his studio in front of his easel. He felt as if he were looking at pictures where the colors had been adjusted for maximum saturation. The leaves and grass were intently, almost poisonously green. Fruit was brighter than jewelry. The birds that dipped and dove through the air had plumage so wildly colorful it made Julian wonder if nothing here hunted them, if they had no other purpose but beauty and display.
"What's wrong?"
He turned around and saw her just behind him on the ridge of the hill. Emma, her long hair untied and flying around her like a sheet of metal hammered thin. His heart lurched, feeling a pull far more insistent than that of fairy music. "Nothing." His voice came out rougher than he'd intended. "Just looking for Mark and Christina. Once I find them, we should go. We've got a lot more walking to do." She moved toward him, her expression wistful. The sun was raying down through the clouds, lightening her hair to rich waves of saffron. Julian clenched his hand tightly, refusing to let himself raise his fingers, to bury them in the pale hair that Emma usually undid only at night. That spoke to Julian of the moments of peace between twilight and nightfall, when the children were asleep and he was alone with Emma. Moments of soft speech and intimacy that far predated any realization on his part that they were anything more than parabatai. In the curve of her sleeping face, in the fall of her hair, in the shadows of her lashes against her cheeks, was a peace he had only rarely known.
"Did you hear the music?" she asked, taking a step closer, close enough to touch.
Julian wondered if this was how drug addicts felt, wanting what they knew they shouldn't have, thinking, "Just this once, won't matter." "Emma, don't," he said. He didn't know what he was asking exactly. "Don't be close to me. I can't bear it. Don't look at me like that. Don't be everything I want and can't have. Don't make me forget your marks. In any way, you could never be mine."
"Please," she said. She looked at him with wide, pained eyes. "Please, I need."
The part of Julian that could never withstand being needed unlocked his clenched hands, his braced feet. He was inside the sphere of her presence in seconds, their bodies almost colliding. He put a hand against her cheek. She wasn't wearing Cortana, he noticed, with a distant puzzlement. Why had she left it behind? Her eyes flashed. She raised herself onto her toes, tilting up her face. Her lips moved, but he couldn't hear what she was saying over the roaring in his own ears. He remembered being knocked down by a wave once, pressed to the bottom of the ocean, breathless and unable to get up. There had been a terror in it, but also a sense of letting go. Something more powerful was carrying him, and he no longer needed to fight. Her arms were around his neck, her lips on his, and he let go, surrendering. His whole body contracted, his heart racing, exploding, veins thrumming with blood and energy. He caught her up against him, small and strong in his arms. He gasped, unable to breathe, tasting the sweet sharpness of blood. But not Emma. He couldn't taste Emma, the familiarity of her, and the scent of her was different, too. Gone was the sweetness of sun-warmed skin, of the herbs in her soap and shampoo, the scent of gear and gold and girl. You don't grow up with someone, dream of them, let them shape your soul and put their fingerprints on your heart and not know when the person you were kissing wasn't them. Julian yanked himself away, wiping the back of his hand across his mouth. Blood smeared his knuckles. He was looking at a fairy woman, her skin smooth and pale, an unmarked, unwrinkled canvas. She was grinning, her lips red. Her hair was the color of cobwebs. It was cobwebs, gray and fine and drifting. She could have been any age at all. Her only clothes were a ragged black shift. She was beautiful, and also hideous.
You delight me, Shadow Hunter, she crooned. Will you not come back to my arms for more kisses?
She reached out. Julian stumbled back. He had never in his life kissed anyone but Emma. He felt sick now, in his heart and guts. He wanted to reach for a seraph blade, to burn the air between them, to feel the familiar heat race up his arms and through his veins to cauterize his nausea. His hand had only just closed around the hilt of the blade when he remembered. It wouldn't work here. Leave him alone, someone shouted. Get away from my brother, Leon and she. It was Mark. He was emerging from a copse of trees with Christina just behind him. There was a dagger in his hand. The ferrywoman laughed.
Your weapons will not work in this realm, Shadow Hunter.
There was a click, and Christina's folding knife bloomed open in her hand. Come and speak your words of challenge to my blade, Barrow Woman. The fairy pulled back with a hiss, and Julian saw his own blood on her teeth. He felt lightheaded with sickness and anger. She whirled and was gone in a moment, a gray-black blur racing down the hill. The music had stopped. The dancers, too, had begun to scatter. The sun was setting, the shadows thick across the ground. Whatever kind of revel it had been, it was one that apparently was not friendly to nightfall. Julian, brother, Mark hurried forward, his eyes concerned. You look ill. Sit down. Drink some water. A soft whistle came from farther up the hill. Julian turned. Emma was standing on the ridge, buckling on Cortana. He saw the relief on her face as she caught sight of them. I wondered where you'd gone, she said, hurrying down the hill. Her smile as she looked at them all was hopeful. I was worried you'd eaten fairy fruit and were running naked around the greensward. No nudity, said Julian. No greensward. Emma tightened the strap on Cortana. Her hair had been pulled back into a long braid, only a few pale tendrils escaping. She looked around at the tense faces, her brown eyes wide. Is everything okay? Julian could still feel the fingerprints of the Leonanshi all over him. He knew what Leonanshi were. Wild fairies who took the shape of whatever you wanted to see, seduced you, and fed on your blood and skin. At least he was the only one who would have seen Emma. Mark and Christina would have seen the Leonanshi in her true form. That was one humiliation and danger spared them all. Everything's fine, he said. We better get going. The stars are just coming out, and we've got a long way still to go.
All right,
Livy said, pausing in front of a narrow wooden door. It didn't look much like the rest of the Institute. Glass and metal and modernity. It seemed like a warning.
Here we go.
She didn't look eager. They decided, with Kit mostly as a silent onlooker, to go directly to Arthur Blackthorne's office. Even if it was 2 in the morning, even if he didn't want to be bothered with Centaurian business, he needed to know what Zara was planning. She was after the Institute, Livy had explained as they scrambled back along the beach and rocks to where they'd started. Surely that's why she'd said what she had about Arthur. Clearly she'd tell any lie. Kit had never thought about institutes much. They'd always struck him as something like police stations, buzzy hives of shadow hunters meant to keep an eye on specific locations. It seemed they were more like small city-states, in charge of a certain area but run by a family, appointed by the council in Idris. There's seriously an entire private country that's just shadow hunters? Kit demanded as they headed up the road to the Institute, rising like a shadow against the mountains behind it. Yes, said Livy tersely. In other words, shut up and listen. Kit had the feeling she was processing what was happening by explaining it to him. He shut up and let her. An institute was run by a head whose family lived with him or her. They also housed families who'd lost members or Nephilim orphans, of whom there were many. The head of an institute had significant power. Most consuls were chosen from that pool, and they could propose new laws, which would be passed if a vote went their way. All institutes were just as empty as the Los Angeles one. In fact, it was unusually crowded at the moment, due to the Centaurian presence. They were meant to be that way, in case they needed to house a battalion of shadow hunters at any moment. There was no staff, as there was no need of one. Shadow hunters who worked for the Institute, called the Conclave, were spread out all over the city in their own houses. Not that there were many of them, either, Livy added grimly. So many had died in the war 5 years ago. But if Zara's father were to become head of the Los Angeles Institute, not only would he be able to propose his bigoted law, but the Blackthorns would be thrown out on their ears, with nowhere to go but Idris. "Is Idris so bad?" Kit had asked as they went up the stairs. Not that he wanted to be shipped off to Idris, he was just getting used to the Institute. Not that he'd want to stay in it if Zara's father took over, not if he was anything like Zara. Livy glanced at Ty, who hadn't interrupted her during her tirade. "Idris is fine, great, even, but this is where we live." They'd reached the door to Arthur's office then, and everything had gone silent. Kit wondered if he should just lead the way. He didn't care particularly if he annoyed Arthur Blackthorne or not. Ty looked at the door with troubled eyes. "We're not supposed to bother Uncle Arthur. We promised Jules."
"We have to," Livy said simply, and pushed the door open.
A narrow set of stairs led to a shadowy room under the eaves of the house. There was a cluster of desks, each with a lamp on it. So many lamps the room was filled with brilliance. Every book, every piece of paper with scrawled writing, every plate with half-eaten food on it, was harshly illuminated. A man sat at one of the desks. He wore a long bathrobe over a ragged sweater and jeans. His feet were bare. The robe had probably once been blue, but was now a sort of dirty white from many washings. He was clearly a Blackthorn. His mostly gray hair curled like Julian's did, and his eyes were a brilliant blue-green. They went past Livy and Ty and fastened on Kit.
"Stephen," he said and dropped the pen he was holding. It hit the ground, spilling ink in a dark pool over the floorboards. Livy's mouth was partly open. Ty was pressed against the wall.
"Uncle Arthur, that's Kit," said Livy. "Kit Herondale."
Arthur chuckled dryly.
"Herondale, indeed," he said.
His eyes seemed to burn. There was a look of sickness in them, like a heat of a fever. He rose to his feet and came over to Kit, staring down into his face.
"Why did you follow Valentine?" he said. "You, who had everything. Yea, is not even Apollo, with hair and harpstring of gold, a bitter god to follow? A beautiful god to behold?"
He smelled bitter of old coffee. Kit took a step back.
"What kind of Herondale will you be?" Arthur whispered. "William or Tobias? Stephen or Jace? Beautiful, bitter, or both?"
"Uncle," said Ty. He pitched his voice loud, though it shook slightly. "We need to talk to you about the Centaurians. They want to take the Institute. They don't want you to be head of it anymore."
Arthur whirled on Ty with a fierce look, almost a glare, but not quite. Then he began to laugh.
"Is that true? Is it?"
he demanded. The laughter built and seemed to break into an almost sob. He whirled around and sat heavily down in his desk chair.
"What a joke," he said savagely.
"It's not a joke," Livy began.
"They want to take the Institute from me," Arthur said, "as if I hold it." "I've never run the Institute in my life, children. He does everything. Writes the correspondence, plans the meetings, speaks with the council."
"Who does everything?" said Kit, though he knew he had no place in the conversation. "Julian."
The voice was Diana's. She was standing at the top of the attic stairs, looking around the room as if the brightness of the light surprised her. Her expression was resigned.
"He means Julian."
Chapter 10.
so wills its king. They were in Diana's office. Through the window, the ocean looked like rippled aluminum, illuminated by black light. I am sorry you had to learn this about your uncle, said Diana. She was leaning back against her desk. She wore jeans and a sweater, but still looked immaculate. Her hair was swept back into a mass of curls, clipped by a leather beret. I had hoped, Julian had hoped, that you'd never know. Kit was leaning against the far wall. Ty and Livy sat on Diana's desk. Both of them looked stunned, as if they were recovering from having the wind knocked out of them. Kit had never been more conscious that they were twins, despite the difference in their coloring.
So, all these years, it's been Julian, said Livy, running the Institute, doing everything, covering up for Arthur.
Kit thought of his drive with Julian to the Shadow Market. He hadn't spent that much time with the second oldest Blackthorn boy, but Julian had always seemed terrifyingly adult to him, as if he were years older than his calendar age. We should have guessed. Ty's hand twisted and untwisted the slim white cords of the headphones looped around his neck. I should have figured it out. We don't see the things that are closest to us, said Diana. It's the nature of people.
But Jules, Livy whispered. He was only 12. It must have been so hard on him.
Her face shone. For a moment, Kit thought it was reflected light from the windows. Then he realized it was tears. He always loved you so much, said Diana. It was what he wanted to do. We need him here, said Ty. We need him here now. I should go, Kit said. He had never felt so uncomfortable. Well, maybe not never. There had been the incident with the 5 drunk werewolves and the cage of newts at the Shadow Market, but rarely. Livy looked up, her tear-stained face baleful. No, you shouldn't. You need to stay here and help us explain to Diana about Zara.
I didn't understand half of what she said, Kit protested, about institute heads and registries.
Ty took a deep breath.
I'll explain, he said.
The recitation of what had happened seemed to calm him down, the regular march of facts, one after another. When he was done, Diana crossed the room and double-locked the door.
Do either of the rest of you remember anything else? Diana asked, turning back to them.
One thing, Kit said, surprised he actually had something to contribute. Zara said the next council meeting was going to be soon.
I assume that's the one where they tell everyone about Arthur, said Livy, and make their play for the Institute.
The cohort is a powerful faction inside the Clave, said Diana. They're a nasty bunch. They believe in interrogating any downworlders they find breaking the accords with torture. They support the Cold Peace unconditionally. If I'd known Zara's father was one of them, she shook her head.
Zara can't have the Institute, said Livy. She can't. It's our home.
She doesn't care about the Institute, said Kit. She and her father want the power it can give.
He thought of the downworlders he knew at the Shadow Market, thought of them rounded up, forced to wear some kind of signs, branded or stamped with identification numbers.
The cohort has the upper hand, though, said Livy. She knows about Arthur, and we can't afford to have anyone find out.
She's right. They'll hand the Institute over to someone else.
Is there anything you know about the Dearborns or the cohort? Something that might discredit them? Said Kit. Keep them from getting the Institute if it was up for grabs?
But we'd still lose the Institute, said Ty.
Yeah, said Kit, but they wouldn't be able to start registering downworlders. Maybe it doesn't sound that harmful, but it never stops there. Zara clearly doesn't care if downworlders live or die. Once she knows where they all are, once they have to report to her, the cohort has power over them. He sighed.
You should really read some mundane history books.
Maybe we could threaten her by saying we'll tell Diego, said Livy. He doesn't know, and I know he was a jerk to Christina, but I can't believe he'd be okay with all this. If he knew, he'd dump Zara, and she doesn't want that.
Diana frowned.
It is not our strongest position, but it is something. She turned to her desk, picked up a pen and notepad. I'm going to write to Alec and Magnus. They head the Downworlder Shadow Hunter Alliance. If anyone knows about the cohort, or any tricks we can use to defeat them, they will.
And if they don't?
We try Diego, said Diana. I wish I believed I could trust him more than I do, but... She sighed. I like him. But I liked Manuel, too. People are not what they seem.
And do we keep telling everyone that Julian and the others went to the academy? Livy asked, sliding off the desk.
Her eyes were dark-rimmed with exhaustion. Ty's shoulders drooped. Kit felt a little as if he'd been hit with a sandbag himself.
If anyone finds out they went to Ferry, it won't matter what we do about Zara. We'll lose the Institute anyway.
We hope they come back soon, Diana said, looking out at the moon's reflection on the ocean water. And if hoping doesn't work, we pray for it.
The woods had gone, and as twilight deepened into true night, the four Shadow Hunters trekked through a spectral land of green fields, separated by low stone walls. Every once in a while, they would see another patch of the strange, blighted earth through the mist. Sometimes they would glimpse the shape of a town in the distance and fall silent, not wanting to attract attention. They had eaten what was left of their food back on the hill, though it wasn't much. Emma wasn't hungry, though. A snarl of misery had taken up residence in her stomach. She couldn't forget what she had seen when she'd woken up, alone, in the grass. Rising, she had looked around for Julian. He was gone, even the impression in the grass where he'd lain beside her fading. The air had been heavy and gray-gold, making her head buzz as she climbed up over the ridge, about to call Julian's name. Then she'd seen him, standing halfway down the hill, the dank air lifting his sleeves, the edges of his hair. He wasn't alone. A fairy girl in a black, ragged shift was with him. Her hair was the color of burnt rose petals, a sort of gray pink drifting around her shoulders. Emma thought the girl looked up at her for a moment and smiled. She might have imagined it, though. She knew she didn't imagine what happened next, when the fairy girl leaned into Jules and kissed him. She wasn't sure what she thought would happen. Some part of her expected Jules to push the girl away. He didn't. Instead, he put his arms around her and drew her in, his hand tangling in her shimmering hair. Emma's stomach turned itself inside out as he pressed her close. He held the fairy girl tightly, their mouths moving together, her hands sliding from his shoulders down his back. There was something almost beautiful about the sight, in a horrible way. It stabbed Emma through with the remembrance of what it had been like to kiss Jules herself. And there was no hesitancy in him, no reluctance, nothing held back, as if he were reserving any piece of himself for Emma. He gave himself up utterly to the kiss, and he was as beautiful doing it as the realization that she had really lost him now was awful. She thought she could actually feel her heart break, like a friable piece of china. The fairy girl had broken away, and then there had been Mark and Christina there, and Emma hadn't been able to watch what was happening. She'd turned away, crumpling into the grass, trying not to throw up. Her hands balled into fists against the ground. Get up, she told herself fiercely. She owed that much to Jules. He'd hidden whatever pain he'd felt when she'd ended things between them. She owed it to him to do the same. Somehow she'd managed to get to her feet, plaster a smile on her face, speak normally when she came down the hill to join the others, nod as they sat and divided up food as the stars came out and Mark determined he could navigate by them, seem unconcerned as they set off, Julian beside his brother, and she and Christina behind them, following Mark down the winding, unmarked paths of Ferry. The sky was radiant now, with multicolored stars, each blazing an individual path of pigment across the sky. Christina was uncharacteristically quiet,
kicking at stones with the toe of her boot as she walked. Mark and Julian were up ahead of them, just far enough to be out of earshot.
¿Qué onda? Christina asked, looking sideways at Emma.
Emma's Spanish was bad, but even she understood. What's going on?
Nothing.
She felt awful about lying to Christina, but worse about her own feelings. Sharing them would only make them seem more real.
Well, good, Christina said. Because I have something to tell you.
She took a deep breath.
I kissed Mark.
Whoa, said Emma, diverted.
Whoa, ho, ho.
Did you just say whoa, ho, ho?
I did,
Emma admitted. So is this like a high-five-slash-chest-bump situation or an oh-my-God-what-are-we-gonna-do situation? Christina tugged nervously on her hair.
I don't know. I like him very much, but at first I thought I was only kissing him because of the fairy drink.
Emma gasped.
You drank fairy wine? Christina! That's how you black out and wake up the next day under a bridge with a tattoo that says, I love helicopters. It wasn't really wine, it was just juice.
Okay, okay, Emma lowered her voice. Do you want me to end things with Mark? I mean, you know, tell the family it's over?
But Julian,
Christina said, looking troubled.
What about him?
For a moment, Emma couldn't speak. She was remembering Julian as the pretty fairy girl had come through the grass toward him. The way she had put her hands on his body, the way his arms had locked across her back. She had never felt jealousy like that before. It still ached in her, like the scar of an old wound. She welcomed the pain in a strange way. It was pain she deserved, she thought. If Julian hurt, she should hurt too. And she had cut him free. He was free to kiss fairy girls and look for love and be happy. He was doing nothing wrong. She remembered what Tessa had told her, that the way to make Julian stop loving her was to make him think she didn't love him. To convince him. It seemed she had. I think my whole charade with Mark has done what it needed to do, she said. So, if you want...
I don't know, Christina said. She took a deep breath. I have to tell you something. Mark and I argued. I didn't mean to, but I...
Stop! It was Mark up ahead. He whirled, Julian beside him, and held out a hand toward them.
Do you hear that?
Emma strained her ears. She wished it was possible to rune herself. She missed the runes that improved speed and hearing and reflex. She shook her head. Mark had changed into what must have been his hunt clothes, darker and more ragged, and had even rubbed dirt into his hair and face. His two-colored eyes glittered in the twilight.
Listen, he said. It's getting louder.
And suddenly Emma could hear it. Music. A sort of music she'd never heard before. Eerie and tuneless. It made her nerves feel like they were wriggling under her skin. The court is near, Mark said. Those are the king's pipers. He plunged into the thicker woods alongside the path, turning only to call, Come along, to the others. They followed. Emma was conscious of Julian just ahead of her. He'd taken out a short sword and was using it to hack away the undergrowth. Piles of leaves and branches studded with small, blood-colored flowers tumbled at her feet. The music was louder now, and grew louder still as they passed through thick forest, the trees above them glimmering with will-o'-the-wisp lights. Multicolored lanterns hung from the branches, pointing the way toward the darkest part of the forest. The Unseelie Court appeared suddenly. A burst of louder music and bright lights that stung Emma's eyes after so long in the dark. She wasn't sure what she'd imagine when she'd tried to picture the Unseelie Court. A massive stone castle, perhaps, with a grim throne room. A dark jewel of a chamber at the top of a tower with a winding gray stair. She recalled the shadowy darkness of the City of Bones, the hush of the place, the chill in the air. But the Unseelie Court was outside, a number of tents and booths not unlike the ones at the Shadow Market, clustered in a glade in a circle of thick trees. The main part of it was a massive draped pavilion with banners of velvet on which was displayed the emblem of a broken crown stamped in gold, flying from every part of the structure. A single tall throne made of smooth, glimmering black stone sat in the pavilion. It was empty. The back was carved with the two halves of a crown, this time hanging above a moon and a sun. A few gentry fairies in dark cloaks were milling around in the pavilion near the throne. Their cloaks bore the crown insignia, and they wore thick gloves like the one Christina had found at the ruins of Malcolm's house. Most were young. Some barely looked older than 14 or 15.
"The Unseelie King's sons," whispered Mark.
They were crouching behind a tumble of boulders, peering around the edges, weapons in hand. Some of them, anyway.
"Doesn't he have any daughters?" Emma muttered.
"He has no use for them," Mark said. "You see, he has girl children killed at birth." Emma couldn't prevent a flinch of anger.
"Just let me get close to him," she whispered. "I'll show him what use girls are."
There was a sudden blare of music. The fairies in the area began to move toward the throne. They were brilliant in their finery, gold and green and blue and flame red, the men as brightly clothed as the women.
"It's almost time," said Mark, straining to see. "The king is calling the gentry to him."
Julian straightened, still hidden by the boulders.
"Then we should move now. I'm going to see if we can get any closer to the pavilion." His short sword gleamed in the moonlight. "Christina," he said, "come with me."
After a single startled moment, Christina nodded.
"Of course."
She took out her knife, sliding a quick apologetic look toward Emma as she and Julian disappeared into the trees. Mark leaned forward against the massive boulder, blocking them from the view of the glade. He didn't look at Emma, only spoke in a low voice.
"I can't do this," he said. "I can no longer lie to my brother."
Emma froze.
"Lie to him about what?" she asked, though she knew the answer.
"About us," he said. "The lie that we're in love. We must end it."
Emma closed her eyes.
"I know, you and Christina."
"She told me," Mark interrupted, "that Julian is in love with you."
Emma didn't open her eyes, but she could still see the bright light of the torches surrounding the pavilion and the clearing burning against her eyelids.
"Emma," Mark said, "it was not her fault. It was an accident. But when she spoke the words to me, I understood. None of this ever had anything to do with Cameron Ashdown, did it? You were trying to protect Julian from his own feelings. If Julian loves you, you must convince him it's impossible for you to love him back."
His sympathy almost broke her. She opened her eyes. Closing them was cowardice, and the Carstairs were not cowards.
"Mark, you know about the law," she said. "And you know Julian's secrets. About Arthur, the Institute. You know what would happen if anyone found out, what they would do to us, to your family."
"I do know," he said, "and I'm not angry with you.
I would stand beside you if you found someone else to deceive him. Sometimes we must deceive the ones we love. But I cannot be the instrument that causes him pain."
"But it can only be you.
You think if there was anyone else, I would have asked you?"
She could hear the desperation in her own voice. Mark's eyes clouded.
"Why only me?"
"Because there isn't anyone else Jules is jealous of," she said, and she saw the astonishment bloom in his eyes. Just as a twig snapped behind her, she whirled, Cortana flashing out.
It was Julian.
"You should know better than to draw steel on your own parabatai," he said, with a crook of a smile. She lowered the blade.
Had he heard anything she and Mark had said? It didn't look like it.
"You should know better than to make noise when you walk."
"No soundless runes," said Jules, and glanced from her to Mark.
"We found a position closer to the throne. Christina's already." But Mark had gone still. He was staring at something Emma couldn't see.
Julian's gaze met hers, full of unguarded alarm, and then Mark was moving, pushing through the undergrowth.
The other two threw themselves after him. Emma could feel sweat gather in the hollow of her back as she strained herself not to step on a twig that might break, a leaf that might crack. It was painful, humbling almost, to realize how much Nephilim relied on their runes. She came up short quickly, almost bumping into Mark. He hadn't gone that far, only to the very edge of the clearing, where he was still hidden from the view of the pavilion by an overgrowth of ferns. Their view of the clearing was unobstructed. Emma could see the unseelie fairies gathered close in front of the throne. There were likely 100 of them, maybe more. They were dressed in stunning finery, much more elegant than she'd imagined. A woman with dark skin wore a dress made of the feathers of a swan, stark and white, a necklace of down encircling her slender throat. Two pale men were dressed in rose silk overcoats and waistcoats of shimmering blue bird's wings. A wheat-skinned woman with hair made of rose petals approached the pavilion. Her dress, an intricate cage of the bones of small animals, fastened together with a thread made of human hair. But Mark was looking at none of them, nor was he looking at the pavilion where the unseelie princess stood, clearly waiting. Instead, he was staring at two of the unseelie princes, both clothed in black silk. One was tall, with deep brown skin, the skull of a raven dipped in gold, dangling around his throat. The other was pale and black-haired, his face narrow and bearded. Slumped between them was the figure of a prisoner, his clothes blood-stained, his body limp. The crowd parted for them, their voices quiet murmurs. "Kieran," Mark whispered. He started forward, but Julian caught the back of his shirt, gripping his brother so tightly that his knuckles turned white. "Not yet," he hissed under his breath. His eyes were flat, glittering. In them, Emma saw the ruthlessness that she had once told him frightened her. Not for herself, but for him. The princes had reached a tall, white-barked tree just to the left and in front of the pavilion. The bearded prince slammed Kieran up against it hard. The prince with the raven necklace spoke to him sharply, shaking his head. The other prince laughed. "The one with the beard is Prince Erek," said Mark, "the king's favorite. The other is Prince Adean. Kieran says that Adean does not like to see people hurt, but Erek enjoys it." It seemed to be true. Erek produced a rope of thorns and held it out toward Adean, who shook his head and walked away toward the pavilion. Shrugging, Erek commenced binding Kieran to the tree trunk. His own hands were protected with thick gloves, but Kieran was wearing only a torn shirt and breeches, and thorns cut into his wrists and ankles, and then his throat when Erek pulled a strand of the vicious rope tight against his skin. Through it all, Kieran slumped inertly, his eyes half closed, clearly beyond caring. Mark tensed, but Julian held on to him. Christina had rejoined them and was pressing her hand over her mouth. She stared as Erek finished with Kieran and stepped back. Blood welled from the lacerations where the thorn bindings cut into Kieran's skin. His head had fallen back against the trunk of the tree. Emma could see his silver eye and the black one as well, both half-lidded. There were bruises on his pale skin, on his cheek and above his hip where his shirt was torn. There was a commotion atop the pavilion, and a single blast from a horn shattered the murmuring quiet in the clearing. The gentry looked up. A tall figure had appeared beside the throne. He was all in white, salt white, with a doublet of white silk and gauntlets of white bone. White horns curled from either side of his head, startling against the blackness of his hair. A gold band encircled his forehead. Christina exhaled. "The king." Emma could see his profile. It was beautiful. Clear, precise, clean, like a drawing or painting of something perfect. Emma couldn't have described the shape of his eyes or cheekbones or the turn of his mouth, and
She lacked Jules' ability to paint it, but she knew it was uncanny and wonderful, and that she would remember the face of the king of the Unseelie court for all her life. He turned, bringing his face into full view. Emma heard Christina gasp faintly. The king's face was divided down the middle. The right side was the face of a young man, luminous with elegance and beauty, though his eye was red as a flame. The left side was an inhuman mask, gray skin tight and leathery over bone, eye socket empty and black, mottled with brutal scars. Kieran, bound to the tree, looked once at the monstrous face of his father and turned his head away, his chin dropping, tangled black hair falling to hide his eyes. Erek hurried toward the pavilion, joining Adayan and a crowd of other princes at their father's side. Mark was breathing hard.
"The face of the Unseelie King," he whispered. "Kieran spoke of it, but..."
"Steady," Julian whispered back. "Wait to hear what he says." As if on cue, the king spoke.
"Folk of the court," he said, "we have gathered here for a sad purpose, to witness justice brought against one of the fair folk who has taken up arms and murdered another in the place of peace. Kieran Hunter stands convicted of the murder of Irloth of the Unseelie court, one of my own knights. He slew him with his blade here in the Unseelie lands."
A murmur ran through the crowd.
"We pay a price for the peace among our folk," said the king.
His voice was like a ringing bell, lovely and echoing. Something touched Emma's shoulder. It was Julian's hand, the one that wasn't clasping Mark's arm. Emma looked at him in surprise, but he was staring ahead toward the clearing.
"No Unseelie fairy shall raise a hand against another. The price of disobedience is justice. Death is paid with death."
Julian's fingers moved quickly against Emma's skin through her shirt, the age-old language of their shared childhood. Stayhere. She whipped around to look at him, but he was already moving. She heard Mark's breath hiss out in a gasp and caught at his wrist, preventing him from going after his brother. Under the starlight, Julian walked out into the clearing full of Unseelie gentry. Emma, her heart pounding, held tight to Mark's wrist. Everything in her wanted to rush out after her parabatai, but he had asked her to stay, and she would stay, and hold on to Mark. Because Julian was moving as if he had a plan, and if he had a plan, she owed it to him to trust that it might work.
"What is he doing?"
Christina moaned in an agony of suspense. Emma could only shake her head. Some of the fairies at the edge of the crowd had spotted him now and were gasping, drawing back as he approached. He had done nothing to cover the black, permanent runes on his skin. The voyant's rune on the back of his hand glared like an eye at the fair folk in their gaudy finery. The woman in the dress made of bones gave a screech.
"Shadow Hunter!" she cried.
The king sat bolt upright. A moment later, a row of fairy knights in black and silver armor, among them the princes who had dragged Kieran to the tree, had surrounded Julian, forming a circle around him. Swords of silver and brass and gold flashed up around him like a grim tribute. Kieran raised his head and stared. The shock on his face as he recognized Julian was complete. The king rose. His bifurcated face was grim and terrible.
"Bring the Shadow Hunter spy to me, that I may kill him with my own hand." "You will not kill me," Julian's voice, calm and confident, rose above the din of voices. "I am no spy. The Clave sent me. And if you kill me, it will mean open war."
The king hesitated. Emma felt a wild half-urge to laugh. Julian had spoken the lie so calmly and confidently that she almost believed it herself. Doubt flickered across the king's face.
"My parabatai," she thought, looking at Jules, standing with his back straight and his head back.
The only 17-year-old boy in the world who could make the king of the dark court doubt himself.
The Clave sent you. Why not an official convoy? Said the king.
Julian nodded as if he expected the question. Probably he had.
There was no time. When we heard of the threat to Kieran Hunter, we knew we had to move immediately.
Kieran made a choked sound. There was a lash of thorned wire around his throat. Blood trickled down onto his collarbone.
What cares the Clave or the Council for the life of a boy from the Wild Hunt? Said the king. And a criminal at that.
He is your own son, said Julian. The king smiled. It was a bizarre sight, as half his face sprang into light and the other displayed a ghastly grimace.
No one can then, he said, accuse me of favoritism. The Unseelie Court extends the hand of justice.
The man he murdered, said Julian, Earloth. He was a kinslayer. He plotted with Malcolm Fade to murder others of the fair folk.
They were of the Seelie Court, said the king. Not of our people.
But you say that you are the ruler of both courts, said Julian. Should not then the people who will one day be yours to rule expect your fairness and clemency? There was a murmur in the crowd, this one softer in tone. The king frowned.
Earloth also murdered Nephilim, said Julian. Kieran prevented other Shadowhunter lives from being lost. Therefore we owe him, and we pay our debts. We will not let you take his life.
What can you do to stop us? Snapped Erek. Alone as you are?
Julian smiled. Though Emma had known him all her life, though he was like another part of herself, the cold surety of that smile sent ice through her veins.
I am not alone.
Emma let go of Mark. He strode forward into the clearing without looking back, and Emma and Christina came after. None of them drew their weapons, though Cortana was strapped to Emma's back, visible to everyone. The crowd parted to let them pass through and join Julian. Emma realized as they stepped into the circle of guards that Mark's feet were still bare. They looked pale as a white cat's paws against the long dark grass. Not that it mattered. Mark was a formidable warrior, even barefoot. Emma had good cause to know. The king looked at them and smiled. Emma didn't like the look of that smile.
What is this? He said. A convoy of children.
We are shadow hunters, said Emma. We bear the mandate of the Clave.
So you said, said Prince Adean. What is your demand?
A good question, said the king.
We demand a trial by combat, said Julian.
The king laughed.
Only one of the fair folk can enter a trial by combat in the Unseelie lands.
I am one of the fair folk, said Mark. I can do it. At that, Kieran began to struggle against his bonds.
No,
he said violently, blood running down his fingers, his chest.
No!
Julian didn't even look at Kieran. Kieran might be who they were here to save, but if they had to torture him to save him, Julian would. You're the boy who does what has to be done, because no one else will, Emma had told him once. It seemed like years ago.
You are a wild hunter, said Erek, and half shadow hunter. You are bound by no laws, and your loyalty is to Gwyn, not to justice. You cannot fight.
His lip curled back.
And the others? I'm not fairy at all.
Not quite true, said Julian.
It has often been said that children and the mad are of the fairy kind, that there is a bond between them, and we are children. Erek snorted.
That's ridiculous. You are grown.
The king called us children, said Julian.
A convoy of children. Would you call your liege lord a liar? There was a collective gasp. Erek went pale.
My lord, he began, turning to the king. Father!
Silence, Erek! You've said enough, said the king.
His gaze was on Julian, the brilliant eye and the dark empty socket.
An interesting one, he said, to no one in particular. This boy, who looks like a shadow hunter and speaks like gentry,
He rose to his feet.
You will have your trial by combat. Knights, lower your blades.
The flashing wall of bright metal around Emma and her friends vanished. Stony faces regarded them instead. Some were princes, bearing the distinct stamp of Kieran's delicate, angular features. Some were badly scarred from past battles. Quite a few had their faces hidden by hoods or veils. Beyond them, the gentry of the court were milling and exclaiming, clearly excited. The words, "Trial by combat," drifted through the clearing.
"You will have your trial," the king said again. "Only I shall pick which of you will be the champion."
"We are all willing," Christina said.
"Of course you are. That is the nature of shadow hunters. Foolish self-sacrifice."
The king turned to glance at Kieran, throwing the skeletal side of his face into sharp relief.
"Now, how to choose? I know. A riddle of sorts."
Emma felt Julian tense. He wouldn't like the idea of a riddle. Too random. Julian didn't like anything he couldn't control.
"Come closer," said the king, beckoning them with a finger.
His hands were pale, like white bark. A hook like a short claw extended from each finger just above the knuckle. The crowd parted to let Emma and the others closer to the pavilion. As they went, Emma was conscious of a strange scent that hung all around them, thick and bittersweet, like tree sap. It intensified as they drew close to the throne until they stood looking up at it, the king looming above them like a statue. Behind him stood a row of knights whose faces were covered by masks wrought from gold and silver and brass. Some were in the shape of rats, some golden lions or silver panthers.
"Truth is to be found in dreams," the king said, looking down at them.
From this angle, Emma could see that the odd splitting of his face ended at his throat, which was ordinary skin.
"Tell me, shadow hunters. You enter a cave. Inside the cave is an egg, lit from within and glowing. You know that it beats with your dreams, not the ones you have during the day, but the ones you half remember in the morning. It splits open. What emerges?"
"A rose," said Mark, "with thorns."
Christina cut her eyes toward him in surprise, but remained motionless.
"An angel," she said, "with bloody hands." "A knife," said Emma, "pure and clean."
"Bars," Julian said quietly, "the bars of a prison cell." The king's expression didn't change. The murmurs of the court around them seemed confused rather than angry or intrigued. The king reached out a long white taloned hand.
"You there, girl, with the bright hair," he said. "You will be the champion of your people."
Relief speared through Emma. It would be her. The others would not be risked. She felt lighter, as if she could breathe again. Christina turned a face toward Emma, looking stricken. Mark seemed to be holding himself in with main force. Julian caught Emma's arm, moving to whisper in her ear, urgency in every line of his body. She stood still, her eyes fixed on his face, letting the chaos of the court flow around her. The coldness of the battle was already beginning to descend on her, the chill that dampened emotions, letting everything but the fight fall away. Julian was part of that. The beginning of battle, and the cold in the middle of it, and the fierceness of the fighting. There was nothing she wanted to look at more in the moments before a battle than his face. Nothing that made her feel more fully at home in herself, more like a shadow hunter. "Remember," Julian whispered into Emma's ear. "You've spilled fairy blood before, in Idris. They would have killed you, killed us all. This is a battle, too. Show no mercy, Emma." "Jules." She didn't know if he heard her say his name. Knights surrounded them, suddenly separating her from the others. Her arm slipped away from Julian's grip. She looked one last time at the three of them before being guided roughly forward. A space was being cleared just in front of the pavilion. A horn blew, a sharp sound parting the night like a knife. One of the princes strode out from behind the pavilion beside a masked knight. The knight wore thick gray armor like an animal's hide. His helmet covered his face. A crude drawing was painted onto the front of the helmet, wide eyes, a mouth, stretched into a grin. Someone had touched the helmet with paint-wet hands, and there were red streaks along the sides that lent an ominous air to what might otherwise have been clownish. The prince guided the masked knight to his side of the cleared space and left him there, facing Emma. He was armed with a longsword of fairy workmanship, its blade silver, traced with gold, its hilt studded with gems. The edges gleamed sharp as razor blades. A strong sword, but nothing could break Cortana. Emma's weapon would not fail her. She could only fail herself.
"You know the rules," said the king in a bored tone. "Once the battle commences, neither warrior can be helped by a friend. The fight is to the death. The victor is he or she who survives."
Emma drew Cortana. It flashed like the setting sun just before it drowned in the sea. There was no reaction from the knight with the painted helmet. Emma focused on his stance. He was taller than her, had greater reach. His feet were carefully planted. Despite the ridiculous helmet, he was clearly a serious fighter. She moved her own feet into position, left foot forward, right foot back, arcing the dominant side of her body toward her opponent.
"Let it begin," said the king.
Like a racehorse bursting out of the box, the knight rushed toward Emma, sword leaping forward. Caught off guard by his speed, Emma spun out of the way of the blade. But it was a late start. She should have raised Cortana earlier. She'd been counting on the swiftness of her sure strike rune, but it was no longer working. A sharp terror she hadn't known in a long time went through her as she felt the whisper of the tip of the knight's sword gliding inches from her side. Emma remembered her father's words when she'd first been learning, "Strike at your enemy, not his weapon." Most fighters went for your blade. A good fighter went for your body. This was a good fighter, but had she expected anything else? The king had chosen him, after all. Now she just had to hope that the king had underestimated her. Two quick turns brought her to a slightly raised hillock of grass. Maybe she could even their height difference. The grass rustled. Emma didn't need to look to know that the knight was plunging toward her again. She whirled, bringing Cortana around in a slicing arc. He barely moved backward. The sword cut along the material of his thick leather armor, opening a wide slit. He didn't flinch, though, or seem hurt. He certainly wasn't slowed down. He lunged for Emma, and she slid into a crouch, his blade whistling over her head. He lunged again, and she sprang back. She could hear her own breath, ragged in the cool air of the forest. The fairy knight was good, and she didn't have the benefit of runes or seraph blades or any of the armaments of a shadow hunter. And what if she was tiring earlier? What if this dark land was sucking out the power in her blood? She parried the blow, leaping back, and remembered oddly Zara's sneering voice.
"Fairies fight dirty," and Mark.
"Fairies don't fight dirty, actually. They fight remarkably clean. They have a strict code of honor." She was already bending, striking at the other knight's ankles. He leapt forward, nearly levitating, and brought his own sword down, just as she seized a handful of leaves and dirt and rose, hurling them at the gaps in the fairy warrior's mask. He choked and stumbled back. It was only a second, but it was enough. Emma slashed at his legs, one, two, and then his torso. Blood soaked his armor chest, and his legs went out from under him, and he hit the ground on his back with a crash like a felled tree. Emma slammed her foot down on his blade as the crowd roared. She could hear Christina calling her name and Julian and Mark. Heart pounding, she stood over the motionless knight. Even now, sprawled on the grass, blackened around him by his own blood, he didn't make a sound.
"Remove his helmet and end it," said the king. "That is our tradition.
Emma took a deep breath. Everything that was Shadow Hunter in her revolted against this, against taking the life of someone lying weaponless at her feet. She thought of what Julian had said to her just before the combat. Show no mercy. The tip of Cortana clanged against the rim of the helmet. She wedged it beneath the edge and pushed. The helmet fell away. The man lying in the grass beneath Emma was human, not fairy. His eyes were blue, his hair blonde, streaked with gray. His face was more familiar to Emma than her own. Her hand fell to her side, Cortana dangling from nerveless fingers. It was her father. Chapter 11. On a Black Throne. Kit sat on the steps of the Institute looking out at the water. It had been a long and uncomfortable day. Things were tenser than ever between the Centaurians and the inhabitants of the Institute, though at least the Centaurians didn't know why. Diana had made a heroic effort to teach lessons, as if everything were normal. No one could concentrate. For once, Kit, despite being completely at sea regarding the comparisons of various seraphic alphabets, wasn't the most distracted person in the room. But the point of the lessons was to keep up appearances in front of the Centaurians, so they slogged on. Things didn't get much better at dinner. After a long, wet day during which they hadn't found anything, the Centaurians were testy. It didn't help that John Cartwright had apparently had some kind of temper tantrum and stalked off, his whereabouts unknown. Judging by Zara's thinly compressed lips, he'd had an argument with her, though about what, Kit could only wonder. The morality of locking warlocks up in camps or escorting fairies to torture chambers, he guessed. Diego and Rayan did their best to make cheerful conversation, but it failed. Livy stared at Diego for most of the meal, probably thinking about their plan to use him to stop Zara, but it was clearly making Diego nervous, since he tried twice to cut his steak with a spoon. To make it worse, Drew and Tavi seemed to pick up on the prickly vibes in the room, and spent dinner peppering Diana with questions about when Julian and the others would be back from their mission. When it was all over, Kit thankfully slipped away, avoiding the washing up after dinner, and found himself a quiet spot under the front portico of the house. The air blowing off the desert was cool and spiced, and the ocean gleamed under the stars, a sheet of deep black that ended in a series of unfurling white waves. For the thousandth time, Kit asked himself what was keeping him here. While it seemed silly to disappear because of awkward dinner conversation, he'd been reminded sharply in the past day that the Blackthorn's problems weren't his, and probably never should be. It was one thing to be Johnny Rook's son. It was another thing completely to be a Herondale. He touched the silver of the ring on his finger, cool against his skin. I didn't know you were out here. It was Ty's voice. Kit knew it before he looked up. The other boy had come around the side of the house and was looking up at him curiously. There was something around Ty's neck, but it wasn't his usual earphones. As he came up the stairs, a slim shadow in dark jeans and sweater, Kit realized it had eyes. He pressed his back against the wall. Is that a ferret? It's wild, said Ty, leaning against the railing around the porch. Ferrets are domesticated, so technically it's a weasel, though if it was domesticated, it would be a ferret. Kit stared at the animal. It blinked its eyes at him and wiggled its small paws. Wow, Kit said. He meant it. The weasel ran down Ty's arm and leapt to the railing, then disappeared into the darkness. Ferrets make good pets, Ty said. They're surprisingly loyal. Or at least people say it's surprising. I don't know why it should be. They're clean, they like toys and quiet, and they can be trained to... He broke off. Are you bored? No. Kit was jolted. Had he looked bored? He'd been enjoying the sound of Ty's voice, lively and thoughtful. Why? Julian says sometimes people don't want to know as much about some topics as I do, said Ty. So I should just ask. I guess that's true for everyone, said Kit. Ty shook his head. No, he said. I'm different.
He didn't sound bothered or at all upset about it. It was a fact he knew about himself, and that was all. Ty had a quiet confidence, Kit found to his surprise, that he envied. He never thought he would have envied anything about a shadow hunter. Ty climbed up onto the porch beside Kit and sat down. He smelled faintly of desert, sand, and sage. Kit thought of the way he'd like the sound of Ty's voice. It was rare to hear someone get that kind of sincere pleasure out of simply sharing information. He guessed it might be a coping mechanism, too. With the unpleasantness of the Centaurians and the worry about Julian and the others, Ty was probably stressed out. "Why are you outside?" Ty asked Kit. "Are you thinking about running away again?" "No," Kit said. He wasn't, really. Maybe a little. Looking at Ty made him not want to think about it. It made him want to discover a mystery so he could present it to Ty for solving, the way you might give someone who loved candy a box of C's. "I wish we all could," Ty said with disarming frankness. "Took us a long time to feel safe here, after the Dark War. Now it feels as if the Institute is full of enemies again." "The Centaurians, you mean?" "I don't like having them all here," said Ty. "I don't like crowds of people in general. When they're all talking at the same time, making noise. Crowds are the worst. Especially places like the pier. Have you ever been there?" He made a face. "All the lights and the shouting and the people. It's like broken glass in my head." "What about fighting?" asked Kit. "Battles, killing demons. That must be pretty noisy and loud." Ty shook his head. "Battle is different. Battle is what Shadowhunters do. Fighting is in my body, not my mind. As long as I can wear my headphones..." He broke off. In the distance, Kit heard a delicate shattering, like a window being blown in by a hurricane. Ty exploded into a standing position, almost stepping on Kit, and drew a seraph blade from his weapons belt. He gripped it, staring out toward the ocean, with a look as set as the glares on the statues in the garden behind the Institute. Kit scrambled up after him, his heart hammering. "What's wrong? What was that?" "Wards. The wards the Centaurians put up. That's the sound of them breaking," said Ty. "Something's coming. Something dangerous." "I thought you said the Institute was safe." "It usually is," Ty said and raised the blade in his hand. "Adriel," he said, and the blade seemed to burn up from within. The glow lit the night, and in its illumination, Kit saw that the road leading up to the Institute was packed with moving shapes. Not human ones. A surge of dark things, slippery and dank and undulating, and a stink rolled up toward them from below, one that almost made Kit gag. He remembered having been on Venice Beach once and passing the rotting corpse of a seal, festooned in maggoty seaweed. It stank like that, but worse. "Hold this," Ty said, and a second later, Kit found that Ty was shoving his blazing seraph blade into Kit's hand. It was like holding a live wire. The sword seemed to pulse and writhe, and it was all Kit could do to hang on to it. "I've never held one of these before," he said. "My brother always says you have to start somewhere." Ty had detached a dagger from his belt. It was short and sharp and seemed altogether less fearsome a weapon than the seraph blade. "Which brother?" Kit wondered, but he didn't have a chance to ask. He could hear shouts now and running feet, and he was glad because the dark tide of things was nearly at the top of the road. He had turned his wrist away he wouldn't have thought was possible, and the blade seemed steadier in his hand. It glowed without heat, as if it were composed of whatever made stars or moonlight. "So, now that everyone's awake," Kit said, "I don't suppose that means we retreat inside?" Ty was pulling his headphones out of his pocket, bracing his black sneakered feet just above the top step. "We're shadow hunters," he said. "We don't run." The moon came out from behind the cloud then, just as the door behind Kit and Ty flew open, and shadow hunters poured out. Several of the Centaurians carried witch lights. The night lit up, and Kit saw the things coming up the road, spilling out into the grass. They clambered toward the Institute, and on the porch the shadow hunters raised their weapons.
Sea demons, he heard Diana say grimly, and Kit knew suddenly that he was about to be in his first real battle, whether he liked it or not. Kit whirled around. The night was full of light and noise. The brilliance of the seraph blades illuminated the darkness, which was a blessing and a curse. Kit could see Livy and Diana with her weapons, followed by Diego, a massive axe in his hand. Zara and the other Centaurians were just behind. But he could also see the sea demons, and they were much worse than he'd imagined. There were things that looked like prehistoric lizards, scaled with stone, their heads a mass of dripping, needle teeth, and dead black eyes. Things that looked like pulsing jelly with fanged mouths, in which hideous organs hung, misshapen hearts, transparent stomachs in which Kit could discern the outlines of what one of them had just eaten, something with human arms and legs. Things like huge squids with leering faces and tentacles, dotted with suckers from which green acid dripped to the ground, leaving seared holes in the grass. The demons who'd killed his father were looking pretty attractive by comparison.
By the angel, Diana breathed.
Get behind me, Centaurians. Zara shot her a nasty look, though the Centaurians were mostly clustered on the porch, gaping. Only Diego looked as if he literally couldn't wait to hurl himself into the fray. Veins stood out on his forehead and his hand trembled with hatred.
We are Centaurians, Zara said. We don't take orders from you.
Diana whirled on her.
Shut up, you stupid child, she said in a voice of cold fury. As if the Dearborns didn't cower in Zurich during the Dark War. You've never been in a real battle. I have. Don't speak another word.
Zara reeled back, rigid with shock. Not a one of her Centaurians, not even Samantha or Manuel, moved to argue for her. The demons, squawking, flapping, and sliding across the grass, had nearly reached the porch. Kit felt Livy edging toward him and Ty moving to stand in front of him. They were trying to block him, he realized suddenly, to protect him. He felt a wave of gratitude, and then a wave of annoyance. Did they think he was a helpless mundane? He fought demons before. Deep down in his soul, something was stirring. Something that made the seraph blade blaze brighter in his hand. Something that made him understand the look on Diego's face as he turned to Diana and said,
Orders!
Kill them all, obviously, Diana said, and the Centaurians began to pour down the stairs. Diego plunged his axe into the first one he saw. Runes gleamed along the blade as it slashed through jelly, spraying gray-black blood. Kit threw himself forward. The space in front of the steps had become a melee. He saw the full power of seraph blades as Centaurians plunged and stabbed, and the air filled with the stench of demon blood. And the blade in his hand blazed and blazed, and something caught his wrist, trapping him at the top of the steps. It was Livy.
No, she said. You're not ready.
I'm fine, he protested. Ty was halfway down the steps. He drew his hand back and flung the dagger he was still holding. It sank into the wide, flat flounder eye of a rearing fish-headed demon, which blinked into oblivion. He turned back to look at Kit and his sister.
Livy, he said, let him.
The door slammed open again, and to Kit's surprise, it was Arthur Blackthorne, still in jeans with his bathrobe over them, but he had jammed his feet into shoes at least. An ancient, tarnished sword dangled from his hand. Diana, locked in combat with a lizard demon, looked up in horror.
Arthur, no!
Arthur was panting. There was terror on his face, but something else as well, sort of fierceness. He hurtled down the steps, flinging himself at the first demon he saw, a fringed, reddish thing with a massive mouth and a long stinger. As the stinger came down, he sliced it in half, sending the creature bobbing and shrieking through the air like a deflated balloon. Livy released Kit. She was staring at her uncle in amazement. Kit turned to descend the stairs just as the demons began to draw back, retreating. But why? The Centaurians had started to cheer as the space before the Institute cleared, but to Kit, it seemed too soon. The demons hadn't been losing. They hadn't been winning, but it was too early for a retreat.
Something's going on, he said, looking between Livy and Ty.
both of whom were poised on the steps with him. Something's wrong. Laughter pierced the air. The demons froze in a semicircle, blocking the way to the road, but not moving forward. In the middle of their semicircle walked a figure out of a horror movie. It had once been a man. He still had the blurred shape of one, but his skin was fish-belly gray-green, and he limped because most of one arm and his side had been chewed away. His shirt hung in rags, showing where the white bones of his ribs had been picked clean, the drained gray skin around his terrible wounds. His hair was mostly gone, though what remained of it was bone white. His face was drowned and bloated, his eyes gone milky, bleached by seawater. He smiled with a mouth that was mostly lipless. In his hand he clutched a black sack, its fabric stained wet and dark.
"Shadow hunters," he said. "How I've missed you."
It was Malcolm Fade. In the silence that followed the unmasking of the Unseelie champion, Julian could hear his own heart slamming against his chest. He felt the burning of his parabatai rune, a clear, searing pain, Emma's pain. He wanted to go to her. She stood like a knight in a painting, her head bowed and her sword at her side, blood splattering her gear, her hair half torn out of its bindings, floating down around her. He saw her lips move. He knew what she was saying, even if he couldn't hear her. It cut through him, with memories of the Emma he had known what seemed like 1,000 years ago, a little girl reaching out her arms for her father to lift her up.
"Daddy?"
The king laughed.
"Cut his throat, girl," he said. "Or can't you kill your own father?"
"Father?" Christina echoed. "What does he mean?" "That's John Costes," said Mark. "Emma's father."
"But how?"
"I don't know," Julian said. "It's impossible." Emma dropped to her knees, sliding Cortana back into its scabbard. In the moonlight, she and her father were shadows as she bent over him. The king began to laugh, his eerie face split by a wide grin, and the court laughed with him, howls of mirth exploding around them. No one was paying attention to the three shadow hunters in the center of the clearing. Julian wanted to go to Emma. He wanted it desperately, but he was someone who was used to not doing or getting what he wanted. He spun toward Mark and Christina. "Go to her," he said to Christina. Her dark eyes widened. "Go to him," he said to Mark. And Mark nodded and slipped into the crowd, a shadow into shadows. Christina disappeared after him, plunging the opposite way into the crowd. The courtiers were still laughing, the sound of their ridicule rising up, painting the night.
"Human emotions are so foolish to them, and human minds and hearts so fragile."
Julian slid a dagger from his belt. Not a serif blade or even a ruined one, but it was cold iron, and it fit comfortably into his palm. The princes among the knights were looking toward the pavilion, laughing. It took Julian only a few steps to reach them, to throw his arms around Prince Erek from the back and press the edge of his dagger to his throat. Kit's first distracted thought was, "So that's why they haven't been able to find Malcolm's body." His second thought was a memory. The High Warlock had been a fixture of the Shadow Market, and friendly with Kit's father, though they had only learned later that they had been more than acquaintances, but partners in crime. Still, the lively purple-eyed warlock had been popular at the market, and had sometimes produced interesting candy for Kit that he claimed came from faraway places he had traveled to. It had been strange for Kit to realize that the friendly warlock he knew was a murderer. It was even stranger now to see what Malcolm had become. The warlock moved forward, stripped of all his previous grace, lurching over the grass. The shadow hunters snapped into formation like a Roman legion. They faced Malcolm in a line, shoulder to shoulder, their weapons out. Only Arthur stood alone.
He stared at Malcolm, his mouth working. The grass in front of them all was seared black and gray by demon blood. Malcolm smirked, as well as he could with his ruined face.
"Arthur," he said, gazing at the shrinking man in his blood-stained bathrobe. "You must miss me. You don't look as if you're doing well without your medication, not at all."
Arthur flattened himself against the Institute wall. There was a murmur among the Centaurians, cut off when Diana spoke. "Malcolm," she said. She sounded remarkably calm, considering. "What do you want?" He came to a stop, close to the Centaurians, though not close enough for them to strike.
"Have you been enjoying looking for my body, Centaurians? It's been a real treat to watch you, splashing around in your invisible boat. No idea what you're looking for, or how to find it. But then, you never have been much use without warlocks, have you?"
"Silence, filth," said Zara, vibrating like an electrical wire. "You—" Divya elbowed her. "Don't," she whispered. "Let Diana talk." "Malcolm," said Diana, in the same cold tone. "Things aren't like they were before. We have the might of the Clave on our side. We know who you are, and we will find out where you are. You are a fool to have come here and show your hand."
"My hand," he mused. "Where is my hand again? Ah, right. It's inside this bag."
He plunged his hand into the sack he'd been carrying. When he drew it out, he was carrying a severed human head. There was a horrified silence.
"John," Diego said hoarsely. Jen Aldertree seemed about to collapse. "Oh, God, poor Marisol. Oh."
Zara was staring with an open-mouthed horror, though she made no move to step forward. Diego took a step, but Rayon caught his arm as Diana snapped, "Centaurians, remain in formation." There was a gagging sound as Malcolm threw John Cartwright's severed head onto the bare grass. Kit realized he'd made the noise himself. He was staring at John's exposed spinal column. It was very white against the dark ground.
"I suppose you're right," Malcolm said to Diana. "It's rather time to give up our pretenses, isn't it? You know my weaknesses, and I know yours. Killing this one," he gestured at John's remains, "took seconds, and taking down your wards took less. Do you think it will take much longer for me to get something I actually want?"
"What is that?" said Diana. "What is it you want, Malcolm?"
"I want what I've always wanted. I want Annabelle, and what it will take to get her back."
Malcolm laughed. It was a gurgling sort of sound.
"I want my blackthorn blood."
Emma couldn't remember dropping to her knees, but she was kneeling. Churned ground and dead leaves were all around her. The fairy knight, her father, was on his back in a pool of spreading blood. It soaked into the already dark earth and turned it nearly black.
"Daddy," she whispered. "Daddy, please look at me."
She hadn't said the word daddy in years, probably since she was 7 years old. Blue eyes opened in his scarred face. He looked just as Emma remembered him. Blonde whiskers where he'd forgotten to shave. Lines of kindness around his eyes. Dried blood spattered his cheek. He stared at her, wide-eyed. The king laughed.
"Cut his throat," he said. "Or can't you kill your own father, girl?"
John Carstairs' lips moved, but no sound came out. "You will see again the face of someone you loved who is dead," the Pooka had said. But Emma had never dreamed this, not this. She caught hold of her father's arm, covered in leathery fairy armor.
I concede, she said raggedly. I concede. I concede. Just help him.
She has conceded, said the king.
The court began to laugh. Laughter rose up around Emma, though she barely heard it. A voice in the back of her head was telling her that this wasn't right. There was a fundamental wrongness here. But the sight of her father was roaring in her head like the sound of a crashing wave. She reached for a steely. He was still a shadow hunter, after all, but dropped her hand. No Irazi would work here.
I won't leave you, she said. Her head was buzzing. I won't leave you here.
She gripped his arm tighter, crouching at the foot of the pavilion, aware of the king's gaze on her, the laughter all around.
I'll stay.
It was Arthur who moved. He burst away from the wall, careening toward Livy and Ty. He seized each of them by the arm and propelled them toward the Institute door. They both struggled, but Arthur seemed shockingly strong. Livy half-turned, calling Kit's name. Arthur kicked the front door open and shoved his niece and nephew through. Kit could hear Livy shouting, and the door slammed behind them. Diana arched an eyebrow at Malcolm.
Blackthorn blood, you said?
Malcolm sighed.
Mad dogs and Englishmen, he said. And sometimes you encounter someone who's both. He can't think that would work.
Are you saying you can get into the Institute? Diego demanded.
I'm saying it doesn't matter, said Malcolm. I set this all up before Emma killed me. My death, and I am dead, though not for long. Isn't the Black Volume wonderful? Release the sea demons along this coast. What you see with me tonight is a tiny fraction of the numbers I control. Either you bring me a Blackthorn, or I send them up on land to murder and destroy mundanes.
We will stop you, Diana said. The Clave will stop you. They will send shadow hunters.
There aren't enough of you, said Malcolm with glee.
He had begun to pace up and down in front of the wall of sea demons that slavered behind him.
That's the beauty of the Dark War. You simply can't hold off every demon in the Pacific. Not with your current numbers. Oh, I'm not saying you might not win eventually. You would. But think of the death toll in the meantime. Is one measly Blackthorn really worth it?
We're not going to give you one of our own to murder, Fade, said Diana. You know better than that.
You don't speak for the Clave, Diana, said Malcolm. And they are not above sacrifices.
He tried to grin, one rotted lip split, and black fluid spilled down his chin.
One for many.
Diana was breathing hard, her shoulders rising and falling angrily.
And then what? All that death and destruction. And what will you gain?
You will also have suffered, said Malcolm. And that is enough for me for now. Let the Blackthorns suffer.
His eyes raked the group in front of him.
Where are my Julian and Emma and Mark? Too cowardly to face me,
he chuckled.
Too bad. I would have liked to have seen Emma's face when she laid eyes on me. You may tell her I said I hope the curse consumes them both.
Consumes who? Kit thought, but Malcolm's gaze had dipped to focus on him, and he saw the warlock's milky eyes glitter.
Sorry about your father, Herondale, said Malcolm. It couldn't be helped.
Kit raised Adriel over his head. The seraph blade was hot under his grip, starting to flicker, but it cast a glow all around him, one he hoped illuminated him enough that the warlock could see it when he spat in his direction. Malcolm's gaze flattened. He turned back to Diana.
I will give you until tomorrow night to decide. Then I will return. If you do not provide a blackthorn to me, the coast will be ravaged. In the meantime,
he snapped his fingers, and a dim purple fire flickered in the air.
Enjoy amusing yourselves with my friends here.
He vanished as the sea demons surged forward toward the Centaurians. Chapter 12 By the Mountains. Mark shoved his way through the Unseelie Court. He had been among these people before only for revels. The court was not always in the same place, but moved around the Unseelie lands. Mark could smell blood on the night air now as he darted among the close-packed gentry. He could smell panic and fear and hate, their hate of shadow hunters. The king was calling to the court to be quiet, but the crowd was shouting for Emma to spill her father's blood. No one was guarding Kieran. He slumped on his knees, the weight of his body pulling against the thorned ropes that held him as if they were barbed wire. Blood oozed sluggishly around the lacerations on his wrists, neck, and ankles. Mark pushed past the last of the courtiers. This close, he could see that Kieran wore something around his neck on a chain. An elf bolt. Mark's elf bolt. Mark's stomach tightened.
Kieran.
He put his hand against the other boy's cheek. Kieran's eyes fluttered open. His face was gray with pain and hopelessness, but his smile was gentle.
So many dreams, he said. Is this the end? Have you come to bear me to the Shining Lands? You could not have chosen a better face to wear.
Mark ran his hands along the ropes of thorns. They were tough. A seraph blade could have cut them, but seraph blades did not work here, leaving him only ordinary daggers. An idea sparked in Mark's mind, and he reached up to gently unfasten the elf bolt from Kieran's throat.
Whatever gods have done this,
Kieran whispered,
they are gracious to bring me the one my soul loves in my last moments.
His head fell back against the tree, exposing the scarlet gashes around his throat where the thorns had cut in.
My Mark.
Hush,
Mark spoke through a tightened throat. The elf bolt was sharp, and he drew the blade of it against the ropes that bound Kieran's throat, and then his wrists. They fell away, and Kieran gave a gasp of pain, relieved.
It is true, as they say, said Kieran. The pain leaves you as you die.
Mark slashed away the ropes binding Kieran's ankles and straightened up.
That is enough, he said. I am Mark, not an illusion. You are not dying, Kieran. You are living.
He took Kieran by the wrist and helped him to his feet.
You are escaping.
Kieran's gaze seemed dazzled by moonlight. He reached for Mark and laid his hands on Mark's shoulders. There was a moment where Mark could have drawn away, but he didn't. He stepped toward Kieran, just as Kieran did toward him, and he could smell blood and cut vines on Kieran, and they were kissing. The curve of Kieran's lips under his own was as familiar to Mark as the taste of sugar or the feel of sunlight. But there was no sugar or sunlight here, nothing bright or sweet, only the dark pressure of the court all around them and the scent of blood. And still, his body responded to Kieran's, pressing the other boy up against the bark of a tree, gripping him, hands sliding on his skin, scars and fresh wounds under his fingertips. Mark felt himself lifted up and out of his body, and he was in the hunt again, hands gripped in Windspear's mane, leaning low into the wind that tore his hair and seared his throat and carried away his laughter. Kieran's arms were around him, the only warm thing in a cold world, and Kieran's lips against his cheek. Something sang by his ear. He jerked away from Kieran. Another object whistled by, and he instinctively crowded Kieran against a tree. Arrows. Each arrow tipped with flame. They ripped their way through the court like deadly fireflies. One of the Unseelie princes was racing toward Mark and Kieran, raising a bow as he came. They had been noticed after all, it seemed. The grass in front of the Institute seemed to boil, a mass of sea demons and centaurians, whipping tentacles and slashing seraph blades. Kit half threw himself down the stairs, almost knocking into Samantha, who, alongside her twin, was battling furiously with a grotesque gray creature covered with sucking red mouths. "Look where you're going!" she yelled, and then shrieked as a tentacle snaked around her chest. Kit whipped Adriel forward, severing the tentacle just above Samantha's shoulder. The demon shrieked from all its mouths and vanished.
"Disgusting,"
said Samantha, who was now covered in thick, grayish demon blood. She was frowning, which seemed ungrateful to Kit, but he hardly had time to worry about it. He was already turning to raise his sword against a spiny-looking creature with nubbly, stony skin like a starfish. He thought of Ty on the beach with the starfish in his hand, smiling. It filled him with rage. He hadn't realized before how much demons seemed like the beautiful things of the world had been warped and sickened and made revolting. The blade came down. The demon shrieked and flinched away, and arms were suddenly around Kit, dragging him backward. It was Diana. She was half-drenched in blood, some human and some demon. She seized hold of Kit's arm, pulling him back toward the stairs, the Institute.
"I'm fine. I don't need help," he panted,
wrenching at her grip. She plucked Adriel out of his hand and threw it toward Diego, who caught the blade and spun to drive it into the thick body of a jellyfish demon, bringing his axe down with the other hand. It was very impressive, but Kit was too angry to care.
"I don't need help,"
he shouted again, as Diana hauled him up the steps.
"I don't need to be saved."
She spun him around to look at her. One of her sleeves was bloody, and there was a red mark on her throat where her necklace had been ripped away. But she was as imperious as always.
"Maybe you don't," she said, "but the Blackthorns do, and you are going to help them."
Stunned, Kit stopped fighting. Diana let go of him and shouldered the doors of the Institute open, stalking inside. After one last glance back, he followed. The moments after Julian seized Erek and put his knife to his throat were chaotic. Several of the fairies near the pavilion howled. The knights fell back, looking terrified. The Unseelie King was shouting. Julian kept his mind focused. "Hold your prisoner. Keep the knife to his throat. If he gets away, you have nothing. If you kill him too quickly, you have nothing. This is your advantage. Take it." At a command from the king, the knights moved aside, forming a sort of tunnel for Julian to walk down, marching Erek ahead of him. The tunnel ended below the king's throne. The king was standing at the edge of the pavilion, his white cloak snapping in the breeze. Erek didn't struggle, but when they reached the pavilion, he craned his head back to look up at his father. Julian could feel them lock eyes.
"You won't cut my son's throat," said the Unseelie King, gazing down at Julian with a look of disdain. "You're a shadow hunter. You have a code of honor."
"You're thinking of shadow hunters the way they used to be," said Julian. "I came of age in the Dark War. I was baptized in blood and fire."
"You are soft," said the king. "Gentle, as angels are gentle."
Julian settled the knife more firmly into the curve of Erek's throat. The fairy prince smelled like fear and blood.
"I killed my own father," he said. "You think I won't kill your son?"
A look of surprise passed over the king's face. Adain spoke.
"He's telling the truth," he said. "Many were in the Hall of Accords during the war. It was witnessed. He is a ruthless one, that one."
The king frowned.
"Adain, be silent."
But he was clearly troubled. Shadows moved behind his eyes.
"The price you would pay for spilling the blood of my family and my court would be unspeakable," he said to Julian. "Not just you would pay it.
All the Clave would pay it.
Then don't make me, said Julian. Let us depart in peace. We will take Erek with us for the distance of a mile, then let him go. No one is to follow us. If we sense we are being followed, we will kill him. I will kill him. Erek cursed and spat.
Let him kill me, father, he said. Let my blood begin the war we know is coming.
The king's eyes rested for a moment on his son. He is the king's favorite, Mark had said. But Julian couldn't help but wonder if the king was more concerned about the war to come, controlling how and when it began, than he was about Erek's fate.
You think angels are gentle, said Julian. They are anything but. They bring justice in blood and heavenly fire. They take vengeance with fists and iron. Their glory is such it would burn out your eyes if you looked at them. It is cold and brutal glory. He met the king's gaze, his angry eye, and his empty one.
Look at me, if you doubt what I say I will do, said Julian. Look at my eyes. Fairies see much, they say. Do you think I am someone who has anything to lose? They were in the entryway. Ty, Livy, Arthur, and the younger ones, Drew holding Tavi in her arms. They lit up when Diana and Kit came in, though Kit didn't know if it was for him or for her. Arthur was sitting on the stairs, silent and staring in his blood-stained bathrobe. He lunged to his feet at the sight of them, though he clung to the banister with one hand.
We heard everything, Livy said. She was gray with shock, her hand in Ty's.
Malcolm wants Blackthorn blood, and he has an army of demons.
When he says Blackthorn blood, there isn't any chance he just means, like, an ounce, said Kit. Maybe a pint? Everyone glared at him, except Ty.
I thought of that, too, Ty said, looking delightedly at Kit. But spells are written in an archaic language. Blackthorn blood means a Blackthorn life.
He isn't getting what he wants, said Diana. She shrugged off her blood-soaked jacket and threw it on the floor. We need a portal, now. She dug around for her phone in her jeans pocket, found it, and began to dial.
But we can't just disappear, said Livy. Malcolm will release all those demons. People will be killed.
You can't bargain with Malcolm, said Diana. He lies. He could get the Blackthorn blood he wants and still release the demons. Getting you safe and striking against him is a better bet.
But she's right, said Kit. Malcolm promised all sorts of things to my dad, including keeping him safe. In the end, it turned out he'd made sure that if anything happened to him, my father would die too. Katerina, Diana turned aside, the phone pressed to her ear. I need a favor, a big one.
We'll all be seen as cowards, said Drew unhappily, running away like this.
You are children, said Arthur. No one would expect you to stand and fight.
He went across the room to the window. No one moved to join him. The sounds coming from outside were enough. Tavi had his face pressed against his sister's shoulder.
To London, said Diana. That's fine. Thanks, Katerina. She hung up the phone.
London, said Livy. Why London?
Why don't we go to Idris, said Drew, where Emma and Jules are?
Katerina can't open a portal to Idris, said Diana, not meeting Drew's gaze. But she has an arrangement with a London institute.
Then we should contact the Clave, said Drew.
She jumped back as the air in front of her began to shimmer.
We need to get our things, said Tavi, looking at the growing shimmer with worry.
It was spreading, a sort of pinwheel now of whirling colors and moving air.
We can't go with nothing.
We don't have time for that, said Diana. And we don't have time to contact the Clave. And there are Blackthorn houses in London, safe places, people you know.
But why? Livy began. If the Clave...
It's entirely possible the Clave would prefer to trade one of you to Malcolm, said Arthur. Isn't that what you mean, Diana?
Diana said nothing. The whirling pinwheel was resolving into a shape, the shape of a door, tall and broad, surrounded by glowing runes.
As would the Centaurians, at least some of them, said Diana. We are running from them as much as anyone else. They are already vanquishing the sea demons. There's little time.
Diego would never, Drew began indignantly.
Diego isn't in charge, said Diana. The portal had resolved into a steady, wavering door, which was open. Through it, Kit could see a living room of sorts, with faded, flowered wallpaper. It seemed incongruous in the extreme. Now come, Drusilla, you first. With a look of despairing anger, Drusilla crossed the room and stepped through the portal, still holding Tavi. Kit watched in stunned amazement as they spun away, vanishing. Livy moved toward the portal next, hand in hand with Ty. She paused in front of it, the force of the magic that pulsed through it, lifting her hair. But we can't leave this place to Zara and the cohort, she protested, turning toward Diana. We can't let them have it. Better than any of you dying, Diana said. Now go. But it was Ty who hesitated. Kit's coming, right? Diana looked at Kit. He felt his throat hurt. He didn't know why. I'm coming, he said. He watched as Livy and Ty stepped into the colorful void, watched as they vanished. Watched as Diana followed, stepped up to the portal himself and paused there looking at Arthur. Did you want to go first? He said. Arthur shook his head. There was an odd look on his face, odd even for Arthur. Though Arthur hadn't been that odd tonight, Kit thought. It was as if the emergency had forced him to hold himself together in a way he normally couldn't. Tell them, he said, and the muscles in his face twitched. Behind him, the front door shook. Someone was trying to open it. Tell them. You'll be able to tell them yourself in a minute, said Kit. He could feel the force of the portal pulling at him. He even thought he could hear voices through it. Ty's voice, Livy's. Yet he stood where he was. Is something going on? He said. Arthur moved toward the portal. For a moment, Kit relaxed, thinking Arthur was going to step into it beside him. Instead, he felt a hand on his shoulder.
Tell Julian, thank you, Arthur said, and shoved hard.
Kit fell into the whirling, soundless nothingness. The fairy prince let fly his arrow. Kieran moved faster than Mark would have thought possible. He swung his body around, covering Mark's. The arrow whistled through the air, singing like a deadly bird. Mark only had time to grab for Kieran to push him away when the arrow struck, burying itself in Kieran's back just below his shoulder blade. He slumped against Mark's shoulder. With his free hand, Mark pulled a dagger from his belt and threw it. The prince fell, screaming, the blade in his thigh. Mark began to drag Kieran from the clearing. The arrows had stopped, but fire was blooming from the banners, with their mark of the broken crown. They had caught fire. The gentry fairies were screaming and milling, many breaking free to run. Still, holding Kieran, Mark vanished into the forest.
Emma? Christina whispered.
The clearing was thick with noise, laughter, hoots, and jeers. In the distance, she could see Julian with his knife to Erek's throat. Gasps rose up as he pushed his way through the king's pavilion, though the king, distracted by Emma, had not yet seen. Emma was kneeling on the ground, gripping the arm of the wounded fairy champion. She looked up and saw Christina, and her eyes brightened.
Help me with my dad, Emma said.
She was tugging at her father's arm, trying to get it looped around her neck. He lay motionless, and for a moment Christina feared he was dead. He pulled away from Emma and lumbered to his feet. He was a slender man, tall, and the family resemblance was clear. He had Emma's features, the shape of her eyes. His were blank, though, their blue dulled to milkiness.
Let me go, he said. Bitch Nephilim girl, let me go. This has gone far enough.
Christina's blood froze at his words. The king burst out into another round of laughter. Christina caught at Emma, pulling her toward her.
Emma, you can't believe everything you see here. This is my father, said Emma.
Christina was holding her wrist. She could feel the pulse pounding in Emma's veins. Emma held her free hand out.
Dad, she said. Please, come with me.
You are Nephilim,
said Emma's father. Faintly on his throat, the white scars of old marks were visible.
If you touch me, I will drag you to the feet of my king, and he will have you killed.
The fairies all around them were giggling, uproarious,
clutching at each other, and the thought that it was Emma's horror and confusion that was making them chuckle sent spikes of murderous rage through Christina's veins. It was one thing to study fairies, one thing to read about how their emotions were not like human emotions, how the unseelie court fairies were raised to find pleasure in the pain of others, to wrap you in a net of words and lies and watch smiling while you choked on their tricks. It was another thing to see it. There was a sudden commotion. The unseelie king ran to the opposite edge of the pavilion. He was shouting orders, the knights in sudden disarray. Julian, Christina thought. And yes, she could see him, Julian holding Erek in front of him at the foot of the king's pavilion. He had deliberately drawn the king away from Emma and Christina. It will be easy enough to decide this, Christina said. She took her Bali song from her belt and held it out to the champion. Take this, she said. Christina, what are you doing? Emma said. It's cold iron, said Christina. She took another two steps toward the champion. His face was changing even as she watched, less and less like Emma's, more and more like something else, something grotesque living under the skin. He's a shadow hunter. Cold iron shouldn't bother him. She moved closer, and the champion, who had looked like John Carstairs, changed completely. His face rippled, and his body flexed and changed, his skin growing mottled and gray-green. His lips pushed outward, and his eyes sprang horrifyingly wide and yellow, his hair receding to show a slick, lumpy pate. Where Emma's father had stood was a fairy knight with a squat body and the head of a toad. Emma stared, white-faced. Its wide mouth opened, and it spoke in a croaking voice.
At last, free to slough the illusion of the disgusting Nephilim.
It didn't finish its sentence. Emma had seized up Cortana and lunged forward, slamming the blade into the knight's throat. It made a wet, squelching sound. Pus-colored blood sprayed from its wide mouth. It staggered back, but Emma followed, twisting the hilt of the knife. The stench of blood and the sound of wetly tearing flesh almost made Christina vomit. Emma! Christina shouted. Emma! Emma drew the sword back and stabbed again and again, until Christina grabbed her shoulders and yanked her back. The fairy knight sunk to the ground, dead. Emma was shaking, spattered with foul blood. She swayed on her feet. Come on! Christina grabbed her friend's arm, started to pull her away from the pavilion. Just then the air exploded with a rustling, singing sound. Arrows. They were tipped with fire, lighting the clearing with an eerie, moving glow. Christina automatically ducked, only to hear a loud clang a few inches from her head. Emma had whipped Cortana to the side, and an arrow had struck the blade, crumbling instantly into pieces. Christina picked up her pace. We have to get out of here. A flaming arrow shot by them and struck a banner dangling from the king's pavilion. The banner caught a light in crackling flames. It illuminated the princes, running from the pavilion, dropping off the edges into shadow. The king still stood before his throne, though, staring down into emptiness. Where was Jules? Where had he and Erek gone? As they neared the edge of the clearing, the fairy woman in the bone dress loomed up in front of them. Her eyes were fish green, without pupils, shimmering like oil in the starlight. Christina brought her foot down hard on the fairy woman's. Her screams were drowned in the court's howls as Christina elbowed her aside. She crashed into the pavilion, small bones raining down from her gown like misshapen snow. Emma's hand was in Christina's. Her fingers felt like ice. Christina tightened her grip. Come on, she said, and they plunged back into the trees. Mark didn't go that far. Julian, Emma, and Christina were still in the court. He pulled Kieran behind a thick oak tree and drew him down to sit leaning against it. Are you all right? Are you in pain? Mark demanded. Kieran looked at him with clear exasperation. Before Mark could stop him, he reached back, grasped the arrow, and yanked it out. Blood came with it, a a welter that soaked the back of his shirt.
Christ, Kieran, what the hell?
What foreign gods do you call on now? Kieran demanded. I thought you said I wasn't dying.
You weren't. Mark pulled off his linen vest, wadding up the material to press it to Kieran's back. Except now I might kill you for being so stupid.
Hunters heal fast, said Kieran with a gasp.
Mark, it really is you.
His eyes were luminous.
I knew you'd come for me.
Mark said nothing. He was concentrating on holding the cloth against Kieran's wound, but a sense of anxiety pressed against the inside of his ribcage. He and Kieran had hardly ended things on good terms. Why would Kieran think Mark would come for him when Mark very nearly hadn't? Kier, he said. He moved the vest away. Kieran was right about the healing. The blood had slowed to a sluggish trickle. Mark dropped the blood-wet linen and touched the side of Kieran's face. It was furnace hot.
You're burning up.
He reached up to sling the elf bolt necklace back around Kieran's throat, but the other boy stopped him.
Why do I have your necklace? He said, frowning. It should be yours.
I gave it back to you, Mark said. Kieran gave a hoarse laugh.
I would remember that.
His eyes went wide, then,
I don't remember killing Eorloth, he said. I know that I did. They told me that much. And I believe it. He was a bastard. But I don't remember it. I don't remember anything after I saw you through the window of the Institute, in the kitchen, talking to that girl, Christina.
Mark went cold all over. Automatically, he slung the elf bolt necklace over his head, feeling it thump against his chest.
Kieran didn't remember?
That meant he didn't remember betraying Mark, telling the Wild Hunt that Mark had shared fairy secrets with Nephilim. He didn't remember the punishment, the whippings Julian and Emma had borne. He didn't remember that Mark had broken things off between them, given him his necklace back. No wonder he thought Mark would come for him.
That girl, Christina, is right here, said a voice above them.
Christina had joined them in the shadows. She looked disheveled, though not nearly as much as Emma, who was splattered with fairy blood and bleeding from a long scratch on her cheek. Mark sprang up. What's going on? Are either of you hurt?
I think we're all right, Emma said. She sounded bewildered and worryingly blank.
Emma killed the king's champion, said Christina, and then closed her mouth. Mark sensed there was more to it, but he didn't press. Emma blinked, slowly focusing on Mark and Kieran.
Oh, it's you, she said to Kieran, sounding more like her old self. Weasel face. Committed any acts of monstrous personal betrayal lately?
Kieran looked stunned. People didn't usually talk to unseelie princes that way, and besides, Mark thought, Kieran no longer remembered why Emma might be angry with him or accuse him of betrayal.
You brought her here with you to rescue me? He said to Mark.
We all came to rescue you. It was Julian, only partly visible behind Erek, who he was shoving ahead of him. Emma exhaled, an audible sound of relief. Julian looked over at her quickly, and they shared a glance. It was what Mark always thought of as the parabatai glance, the quick once-over to make sure the other person was all right, that they were beside you, safe and living. Though now that he knew of Julian's true feelings for Emma, he couldn't help but wonder if there was a layer more to what they shared. Erek's throat was bleeding where the dagger had likely slipped. He was glaring out from beneath black brows, his face contorted into a snarl.
Blood traitor, he said to Kieran. He spat past the knife. Kinslayer.
Eorloth was no kin of mine, said Kieran in an exhausted voice.
He was more your kin than these monsters, said Erek, glaring around at the shadow hunters surrounding him. Even now, you betray us for them.
As you betrayed me to the king, our father, said Kieran. He was huddled among the tree roots, looking surprisingly small. But when he tipped his face back to look at Erek, his eyes were hard as gems.
You think I don't know who told the king I killed Eorloth? You think I don't know at whose feet I can lay blame for my exile to the hunt?
Arrogant, said Erek.
You've always been arrogant, whelp, thinking you belonged in the court with the rest of us. I am the king's favorite, not you. You earn no special place in his heart, or the hearts of the court.
Yet they liked me better, Kieran said quietly. Before. Enough, said Julian. The court is on fire. Knights will be coming after us as soon as the chaos dies down. It's madness to stay here and gossip.
Important court business is not gossip, snarled Erek.
It is to me, Julian peered through the woods. There must be a quick way out of here, towards Sealy Lands. Can you lead us? Erek was silent.
He can, said Kieran, rising unsteadily to his feet. He can't lie and say it's not possible. That's why he's not talking. Emma raised an eyebrow at Kieran.
Weasel face, you're surprisingly helpful when you want to be.
I wish you would not be so familiar, Kieran said disapprovingly. Erek made a grunting noise. Julian was digging the knife into his neck. There was a slight tremble to Julian's hand, his grip on the blade. Mark imagined it must be a physical strain to keep Erek contained, but he suspected there was more to it than that. Julian did not have a torturer's nature, for all that he could and would be ruthless in protecting those he loved.
I will kill you if you don't take us in the right direction, he said now. I will do it slowly.
You promised my father—
I am not a fairy, said Julian. I can lie. Erek looked darkly furious in a way that alarmed Mark. Fairies could hold grudges for a very long time. He began to walk, though, and the others followed him, leaving behind the orange light glowing from the clearing. They headed into the dark fastness of the forest. The trees grew closer, and there were thick roots snaking up from the dark soil. Clusters of flowers in deep colors, blood reds and poison greens, clustered around the low boughs of the trees. They passed a giggling tree fairy who sat in the fork of a branch, naked except for an elaborate net of silvery wires, and winked at Mark as he went by. Kieran was leaning heavily against his shoulder. Mark kept a hand splayed in the small of Kieran's back. Were the others puzzled or wondering what was going on between them? He saw Christina glance back toward him, but couldn't read her expression. Emma and Christina walked close together. Julian was in front, letting Erek guide them. Mark still felt uneasiness. It seemed as if they had gotten away too easily. For the king of the Unseelie court to have let them go, and to have them take his favorite son.
Where are the others?
Erek asked as the trees thinned out and the sky, multicolored in all its glory, became visible.
Your friends.
Friends? Mark said in a puzzled tone.
The archers, said Erek. Those flaming arrows in the court. Clever, I'll grant you. We wondered how you would cope with weapons once we took your angel powers away.
How did you do that? Mark asked. Did you unhallow all this land? That wouldn't make a difference, said Emma. Runes work even in demon realms. This is something stranger.
And the blight, said Mark. What is the meaning of the blighted land?
It is everywhere in the Unseelie lands, like cancer in a sick body.
As if I would speak of it, snapped Erek. And it is no use threatening me. It would be worth my life to tell you.
Believe me, I am tired of threatening you myself, said Julian.
Then let me go, said Erek. How long do you plan to keep me, forever? For that is how long you'd have to use me for protection to keep my father and his knights from finding you and cutting your throats.
I said I was tired of threatening you, not that I was going to stop doing it, said Jules, tapping the knife blade. They'd come to the edge of the forest where the trees ended and fields began. Now, which way? Erek set off into the field, and they followed. Kieran was leaning more heavily on Mark. His face was very pale in the moonlight. The stars picked out the blue and green in his hair. His mother had been an ocean fairy. And a little of the shimmering loveliness of water remained in the colors of Kieran's hair and eyes. Mark's arm curved around him unconsciously. He was angry at Kieran, yes, but here in Faerie, under the brilliant polychromatic stars, It was hard not to remember the past, not to think of all the times he'd clung to Kieran for warmth and companionship. How it had just been them, and he thought perhaps it always would be. How he'd thought himself lucky that someone like Kieran, a prince, and beautiful, would ever look at him. Kieran's whisper was a light caress against Mark's neck.
Windspear.
Windspear was Kieran's horse, or had been. He had come with him from the court when Kieran had joined the hunt.
What about him? Where is he?
With the hunt, said Kieran, and coughed hard.
He was a gift from Adain when I was very young.
Mark had never before met Kieran's half-brothers, the dozens of princes by different mothers who vied for the Unseelie throne. Adain, he knew from Kieran's tales, was one of the kinder ones. Erek was the opposite. He had been brutal to Kieran for most of his life. Kieran rarely spoke of him without anger.
I thought I heard his hoofbeats, Kieran said. I hear them still.
Mark listened. At first he heard nothing. His hearing was not as sharp as Kieran's, or any true fairy's. At least not when his runes weren't working. He had to strain his ears to finally hear the sound. It was hoofbeats, but not windspears. Not any one horse's. This was a thunder of hoofbeats, dozens of them, coming from the forest. Julian, he cried. There was no keeping the panic from his voice. Jules heard it and turned, fast, his grip on Erek loosening. Erek tore away, exploding into motion. He streaked across the field, his black cloak flying behind him, and plunged into the forest.
And he was such awesome company, too, Emma muttered.
All that Nephilim you will die in a welter of your own blood stuff was really refreshing. She paused. She had heard the horses.
What's that?
Cortana seemed to fly into her hand. Julian was still holding his dagger. Christina had reached for her balisong.
The king's cavalry, said Kieran with surprising calm. You cannot fight them.
We must run, Mark said. Now. No one argued. They ran. They tore through the field, leapt a stone wall on the far side, Mark half-carrying Kieran over. The ground had begun to tremble by then with a force of distant hoofbeats. Julian was swearing a low, steady stream of curses. Mark guessed he didn't get to swear all that much back at the Institute. They were moving fast, but not fast enough, unless they could find more woods, some kind of cover. But nothing was visible in the distance, and looking up at the stars told Mark little. He was exhausted enough that they dizzied him. Half his strength felt as if it were going to Kieran, not just dragging him along, but willing him upright. They reached another wall, not high enough to stop fairy horses, but high enough to be annoying. Emma leapt it. Julian sprang after her, his fingers lightly brushing the top of the wall as he sailed over. Kieran shook his head.
I cannot do it, he said.
Kier, Mark began angrily, but Kieran had his head down like a beaten dog. His hair fell, sweat tangled into his face, and his shirt and the waist of his breeches were soaked in blood.
You're bleeding again. I thought you said you were healing.
I thought I was, Kieran said softly.
Mark, leave me here.
A hand touched Mark's shoulder. Christina. She had put her knife away. She looked at him levelly.
I'll help you get him over the wall.
Thanks, Mark said. Kieran didn't seem to even have the energy to look at her angrily. She scrambled to the wall's top and reached her hands down. Together, she and Mark hauled Kieran up over the barrier. They jumped down into the grass beside Emma and Julian, who were waiting, looking worried. Kieran landed beside them and collapsed to the ground.
He can't keep running, said Mark.
Julian glanced over the wall. The hoofbeats were loud now, like thunder overhead. The leading edge of the Unseelie cavalry was in view, a dark and moving line. He has to, he said. They'll kill us.
Leave me here, said Kieran. Let him kill me.
Julian dropped to one knee. He put a hand under Kieran's chin, forcing the prince's face up so their eyes met. You called me ruthless, he said, his fingers pale against Kieran's bloodied skin. I have no pity for you, Kieran. You brought this on yourself. But if you think we came all the way here to save your life just to let you lie down and die, you're more foolish than I thought. His hand fell from Kieran's face to his arm, hauling him upright. Help me, Mark. Together they lifted Kieran between them and started forward. It was a blindingly hard task. Panic and the strain of holding up Kieran threw off Mark's hunting senses. They stumbled over rocks and roots, plunged into a thick copse of trees, its branches reaching down to tear at their skin and gear. Halfway through the copse, Kieran went limp. He had finally fainted.
If he dies, Mark began.
He won't die, Julian said grimly.
We could hide him here, come back to get him.
He's not a pair of shoes. We can't just leave him somewhere and expect him to be there when we get back, Julian hissed.
Would you two stop? Emma began and then broke off with a gasp.
Oh. They had burst out of the small patch of trees. In front of them rose a hill, green and smooth. They could climb it, but it would demand digging in with hands and feet, scrambling over the top. It would be impossible to do and keep Kieran with them. Even Julian stopped dead. Kieran's arm had been looped around Julian's neck. Now it swung free, dangling at his side. Mark had the distant, horrible feeling he was already dead. He wanted to lay Kieran down in the grass, check for his heartbeat, hold him as a hunter should be held in his last moments. Instead, he turned his head and looked behind them. Christina had her eyes closed. She was holding her pendant, her mouth moving in silent prayer. Emma held Cortana the same way, her eyes watchful and glittering. She would defend them to the last, Kieran too. She would go down under the hooves of the dark cavalry. And they were coming. Mark could see them, shadows between the trees. Horses like black smoke, blazing eyes like red coals, shot in silver and burning gold. Fire and blood gave them life. They were murderous and brutal. Mark thought he could see the king riding at their head. His battle helmet was etched with a pattern of screaming faces. Its faceplate covered only that half of the king's face that was human and beautiful, leaving the dead gray skin exposed. His single eye burned like red poison. The sound of their coming was like the sound of a glacier breaking apart, deafening, deadly. Mark wished suddenly that he could hear what Christina was saying, the words of her quiet prayer. He watched her lips move.
Angel, provide for us. Bless us. Save us.
Mark! Julian turned his head toward his brother, his blue-green eyes suddenly unguarded, as if he were about to say something he had been desperate to say for a long time. If you... The hill seemed to crack apart. A large square in the front of it peeled away from the rest and swung open like a door. Mark's mouth fell open. He had heard of such things, hills with doors in the sides, but he had never seen one. Light glowed from the opening. It seemed to be a corridor winding into the heart of the hill. A young fairy woman with gently pointed ears, her pale hair bound back with ropes of flowers, stood in the entryway holding a lamp. She reached out a hand toward them.
Come, she said, and her voice had the undeniable accent of the Seelie court. Come, quickly, before they reach you. For the king's right is a savage, and they will not leave you alive.
And you, Julian said, do you mean us well? Only Julian would argue with Providence, Mark thought. But then Julian trusted no one but his family, and sometimes not even them. The woman smiled.
I am Neen, she said. I will aid you and not harm you, but come now, quickly.
Mark heard Christina whisper a thank you. Then they were all racing again, not daring to look behind them. One by one they leapt through the door and onto the packed earth inside. Mark and Julian came last, carrying Kieran. Mark caught one glimpse of the dark riders behind them and heard their screams of disappointed rage. Then a door slammed shut behind them, sealing up the hill. Chapter 13 Dreamland. Emma looked around in wonder. The entranceway bore no traces of having been carved out of a hillside. It was made of smooth, ash-colored stone, the roof of blue marble pattern with gilded stars. A shadowed corridor led deeper into the hill. The ferrywoman, Neen, raised her lamp. It was filled with darting fireflies that cast a limited glow over their small group. Emma saw Julian with his mouth set in a hard line, Christina holding her pendant tightly. Mark was lowering Kieran to the ground, his hands gentle. It took her a moment to realize Kieran was unconscious, his head lolling back, clothes dappled in blood. "We are in Seelie Lands now," said Neen. "You can use your runes and witchlights." Her gaze on Kieran was troubled. "You can heal your friend." "We can't," Julian flipped his witchlight out of his pocket. Its illumination rushed over Emma like a relief of water in the desert. "He's not a shadow hunter." Neen drifted closer, her pale eyebrows arched in consternation. Mark was on the ground, holding Kieran, whose face was drained icy white, his closed eyes pale crescents in his blanched face.
"Is he a hunter?" she asked.
"We both," began Mark.
"Is there anything you can do for him?" Emma interrupted before Mark said too much.
"Yes." Neen knelt down, setting her lamp on the floor beside her. She took a vial from the inside of the sleeveless white fur jacket she wore over her dress. She hesitated, looking at Mark.
"You do not need this. You are not injured."
He shook his head, puzzled.
"No, why?" "I brought it for you."
She uncorked it, setting it to Kieran's lips. She crooned something under her breath in a language unfamiliar to Emma. Kieran's lips parted and he swallowed. Pale gold liquid ran from the corners of his mouth. His eyes fluttered open and he pulled himself upright, swallowing a second mouthful and a third. His eyes met Neen's over the rim of the bottle, and he turned his face away, wiping his mouth with his sleeve.
"Save the rest," he said hoarsely. "It's enough."
He staggered to his feet, Mark helping him. The others had put away their steelies. A new healing rune burned on Emma's arm, an energy rune beside it. Still her body ached and her heart hurt. She kept seeing her father, over and over, looking up at her from the grass. It hadn't been him, not really, but that didn't make the image less painful.
"Come," said Neen, putting the vial away. "The drink will only sustain him for a short time. We must hurry to the court."
She started down the corridor, and the others followed, Mark supporting the staggering Kieran. Julian had his witchlight stone out, and the hall was bright. The walls looked like intricate mosaic from a distance, but up close, Emma could see they were clear resin, behind which the petals of flowers and wings of butterflies were pressed flat.
"My lady," said Christina.
Her hair, like Emma's, was tangled with leaves and burrs.
"What did you mean you brought that drink for Mark? How did you know he would come here?"
"We had guests here in the court," said Neen, "a shadow hunter girl with red hair and a blonde boy."
"Chase Herondale and Clary Fairchild?"
guessed Emma.
"They told me of the Blackthorns. That was a name I knew. My sister, Nerissa, loved a Blackthorn man, and had two of his children, and died of her love for him when he left her."
Mark stopped in his tracks. Kieran gave a slight hiss of pain.
"You're my mother's sister?" he said incredulously.
"I think they usually call that your aunt," said Emma. Mark gave her a dark look.
"I am the one who carried you and your sister to your father's doorstep and left you there for him to raise," said Neen. "You are my blood."
"I am beginning to wonder if any of you do not have a long-lost relative in Faerie," said Kieran.
"I don't," said Christina, sounding regretful. "Half Mark's relatives are fairies," pointed out Emma. "Where else would they be?"
"How did you know I would need saving?" said Mark to the fairy woman.
"The Pooka, who let you through the moon gate, is an old friend," Neen said. "He told me of your journey, and I guessed your mission. I knew you would not survive the Lord of Shadows' tricks without aid."
"The burning arrows," Julian said.
The corridor had now turned from stone and tile to packed earth.
Roots dangled from the ceiling, each one twined with glimmering flowers that lit the darkness. Veins of minerals in the rocks shimmered and changed as Emma looked at them.
That was you?
Neen nodded.
And a few others of the Queen's Guard. Then I had only to stay a few steps ahead of you and open this door.
It was not simple. There are many doors to Seelie, all over the King's lands. More than he knows. She cast a sharp look at Kieran.
You will not speak of this, will you, Hunter?
I thought you imagined me Nephilim, said Kieran.
That was before I saw your eyes, she said. Like my nephew. You are a servant of Gwyn, she sighed softly. If my sister Nerissa had known her son would grow to be so cursed, it would have broken her heart.
Julian's face darkened, but before he could speak, a figure loomed up in front of them. They had reached a place where the corridor opened into a circular room, with other hallways leading off it in a dizzying array of directions. Blocking their forward progress was a fairy knight, a tall, wheat-skinned man with a somber expression. He wore robes and a doublet of brilliant multicolored fabric.
Fergus, said Neen, let us go by.
He arched a dark brow and replied with a torrent of words in an odd, bird-like language, not angry, but clearly annoyed. Neen held up her hand, her voice sharp in response. As Emma watched her, she thought she could detect some resemblance to Mark. Not just the pale blonde hair, but the delicacy of her bones, the deliberateness of her gestures. The knight sighed and stepped aside.
We can go now, but we will be called to an audience with the Queen at first light, said Neen, hurrying forward.
Come, help me get the hunter to a room.
Emma had quite a few questions. How could they tell it was first light down here? Why Neen seemed to dislike the Wild Hunt so much, and, of course, where they were going. She kept them to herself, though, and eventually they reached the end of a corridor where the walls were polished rock, gleaming with semi-precious stones, tiger's eye, azurite, jasper. Gaps in the rock were covered with long velvet hangings embroidered with glimmering thread. Neen swept one of the hangings aside, revealing a room whose walls were smooth and curved in toward a domed ceiling. White hangings drifted down, half covering a bed made of thick branches wound with flowers. Neen set down her lamp.
Lay the hunter down, she said.
Kieran had gone silent since they'd entered the Seelie court proper. He let Mark lead him over to the bed. He looked pretty awful, Emma thought, as Mark helped Kieran settle into the mattress. She wondered how many times Mark had done this sort of thing for Kieran, when Kieran was exhausted after a hunt, or how many times Kieran had done it for Mark. Being a hunter was a risky job. She couldn't imagine how much of each other's blood they'd seen. "Is there a healer in this court?" Mark asked, straightening up.
"I am the healer," said Neen, "though I rarely work alone. Usually I am assisted, but the hour is late and the court is half empty."
Her gaze fell on Christina.
"You will help me."
"Me?" Christina looked startled.
"You have a healing air about you," said Neen, bustling up to a wooden cabinet and throwing the doors open.
In it were jars of herbs, dangling strings of dried flowers, and vials of different colored liquids.
"Can you name any of these?"
"Foam flower," said Christina promptly, as if they were in class. "Miner's lettuce, false lily, queen's cup." Neen looked impressed. She pulled a stack of linens, including strips cut neatly into bandage size, from a drawer and handed them to Christina. "Too many people in the room will slow a patient's healing. I will take these two next door. You must remove Kieran's clothes." Christina's cheeks flamed.
"Mark can do that."
Neen rolled her eyes.
"As you like."
She turned toward the bed where Kieran was collapsed back against the pillows. There were rusty smears of blood all over Mark's shirt and skin, but he didn't seem to notice.
"Crush some foam flour. Give it to him with water. Do not bandage him yet. We must inspect the wound."
She hurried from the room, and Emma and Julian dashed after her. They went only a few steps down the corridor,
to where a dark red curtain hid an open door. Neen pushed it aside and gestured the two of them to come in. Once inside, Emma had to suppress a gasp. This room was much grander than the other. The roof was lost in shadows. The walls were silvery quartz and glowed from within, lighting the room with a soft radiance. Creamy white and ivory flowers cascaded down the walls, perfuming the air with the scent of a garden. A massive bed stood on a platform, steps leading up to it. It was piled with velvet cushions and a rich coverlet.
"Will this do?" Neen asked.
Emma could only nod. A hedge, atop which grew a lattice of roses, stretched across one end of the room, and behind it a cascade of water rushing down the rocks. When she glanced around the hedge, she saw that it emptied into a rock pool lined with green and blue stones that formed the shape of a butterfly.
"Not as fancy as the Institute," she heard Julian say, "but it'll do."
"Whose room is this?" Emma asked. "Is it the Queen's?"
Neen laughed.
"The Queen's chambers? Certainly not. This is Fergus's.
Actually, he has two. He is much favored in the court. He won't mind if you sleep here. He has night watch." She turned to walk away, but stopped at the curtain and glanced back at them.
"You are my nephew's brother and sister?"
Emma opened her mouth, then closed it again. Mark was more of a brother to her than anything else, certainly more of a brother than Julian. "Yes," Julian said, sensing her hesitation.
"And you love him?" said Neen.
"I think you will find, if you take the time to get to know him, that he is easy to love," said Jules. And Emma's heart expanded, yearning for him and Mark together, happy and laughing as brothers should be, and for the challenge in Julian's eyes when he looked at Neen. "You owe my brother the love he deserves. Show it, or I turn my back on you."
Neen cleared her throat. "And my niece, Alessa?"
"Her name is Helen now," said Julian. He paused for a moment, and Emma could see him weighing the mention of Helen's situation and dismissing it. He did not trust Neen enough, not yet. "Yes, she is my sister. Yes, I love her as I love Mark. They are both easy to love."
"Easy to love," echoed Neen in a musing voice. "There are few of our people I would ever have said were easy to love." She ducked back through the door.
"I must hurry back before the Hunter boy expires," she said, and was gone. Julian looked at Emma with arched eyebrows.
"She's very..."
"Yes," agreed Emma, not needing the rest of the words to know what he meant. She and Julian almost always agreed on people. She felt her mouth curve up as she smiled at him, despite everything, despite the incredible, impossible strain of the night. "And it wasn't as if the risk was over," she thought, turning to gaze at the room. She had hardly ever been in such a beautiful space. She had even heard of cave hotels, places in Cappadocia and Greece where gorgeous rooms were dug out of rocks and draped with silks and velvets. But it was the flowers here that tugged at her heart. Those white flowers that smelled like cream and sugar, like the white flowers that grew in Idris, they seemed to radiate light. And then there was the bed. With a sort of belated shock, she realized that she and Julian had been left alone together in a wildly romantic room with only one very large, very plush bed. Definitely, the night's worries were not over. At all. When Neen returned, she cleaned Kieran's wound gently with damp linens, pressing the edges of the cut carefully with her fingers. He sat upright and rigid on the edge of the bed, not moving or acknowledging what was going on, but Christina could see from the deep crescent marking his lower lip that he was in pain. Mark sat quietly beside him. He seemed wrung out, exhausted, and did not move to hold Kieran's hand, only sat with his shoulder touching the other boy's. But then They had never been the hand-holding type, Christina thought. The Wild Hunt was not a place where such gentle expressions of affection were welcome.
There was monk's hood on the Unsealiero, Neen said when she was done cleaning the wound. She held her hand out for a bandage and began wrapping Kieran's slender torso. He had been undressed and redressed in clean trousers, a shirt folded on the bed next to him. There were scars on Kieran's back, not unlike the ones on Mark's, and they stretched to the tops of his arms and down his forearms, too. He was thin but strong-looking, with clear lines of muscles in his arms and across his chest.
If you were human, or even ordinary fey, it would have killed you. But hunters have their own protection. You will live.
Yes, Kieran said with an arrogant tilt to his chin. But Christina wondered. He didn't say, yes, I knew I would live. He had doubted, she suspected. He had feared he would die. She rather admired his bravery. She couldn't help it.
Neen rolled her eyes, finishing with the bandages. She tapped Christina's shoulder as Kieran shrugged his shirt on, doing the buttons up with slow, shaking fingers, and indicated a shallow marble dish on the nightstand, filled with damp cloths swimming in a greenish liquid.
Those are poultices to prevent infection. Put a new one on the wound every 2 hours.
Christina nodded. She wasn't sure how she would set an alarm or wake up every 2 hours, or if she was simply meant to stay awake through the night, but she would manage either way.
Here, Neen said, leaning down to Kieran with another vial. Drink this. It will not harm you, only help you. After a